Need to order.
The Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims has begun, and we will first order of business. We will have the approval of the minutes of May 7th. Will you send a roll call or any of that?
Approval.
Minutes have been moved to be approved. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion for bill. First order of business. How do I pronounce that?
Okino.
Mr. Okino. Is there a Mr. Okino here?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, can I talk about this claim a little bit, introduce it?
That sounds very good. Mr. Okino, just have a seat right there.
And you're going to have to sign your name on that witness
sheet there.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Okino has some experience with the claim subcommittee. As his current claim points out, he was actually granted $5,000 in the claims bill of 1975, which is before I started working for the legislature. So I didn't know anything about that. Mike Yowis apparently introduced a bill. You had to introduce a bill at the time. And it was referred to the claims subcommittee, and Mr. Okino was paid $5,000 for lost wages during a period of improper confinement at St. Peter. And then in 1995, Mr. Okino brought a claim against the Department of Human Rights for $40,275. It related to wrongfully being denied employment with the city of Duluth. He answered questions. Again, most of our records for this period are gone, so all I have is the minutes of that meeting to look at. But Mr. Okino testified, explained the details, answered questions of the committee. Senator Randy Kelly said they would make a decision in the near future. Mr. Okino thanked the committee members, and that was that claim. It was actually decided, denied, at the very next meeting of the claims subcommittee, which was in December of 95. So that's the history of Mr. Okino and the claims subcommittee. The current claim has to do with, it's filed ostensibly against the Department of Human Services, but it's basically a claim saying that the state has somehow not notified people up in Duluth and St. Louis County of Mr. Okino's condition, or the fact that he got a claim back in 1975, and as a result they've been harassing him. I'm sure Mr. Okino will explain it better than I have.
Mr. Okino, welcome to the committee, and I know you've traveled quite a distance to your bus today. So.
I have. Through our bus lane. Anyway, as I stated in my claim against, in other words, basically, against not only the state, but I mean, for the confinement of being in St. Peter, I did receive the $5,000 back in 19, and the laws of 1975 will reflect that in that, in these here sheets that all the members have. Mm-hmm. And anyway, the thing is, when I received that $5,000, it should have ended right there. And whatever I tried to do regarding employment, or whatever I tried to do, shouldn't have been treated like, well, that person was away, because I might have been away, but I was away improperly, and if you have the papers, there's some records here from the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal, there's a letter from the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. There's a letter from Kimberly, Special Agent Kimberly Del Greco in Clarksburg, West Virginia. She's an FBI agent. And there's an FBI report from Clarksburg, West Virginia. And there's also the statement that states that I got the $5,000 to begin with. Well, anyway, the thing which Ms. Kimberly Del Greco said is that she checked with the Minnesota DCA, and the Minnesota DCA had cleared, in other words, all records of that their charge. And I never was tried for that charge. I know that I didn't do it. The case was dismissed. The case was dismissed for improper. In other words, there was insufficient evidence to warrant a burglary charge. And anyway, the thing is, there's also a letter here from Cindy Stradioli. And she happens to be the Chief Deputy Court Administrator for St. Louis County. And it says, we have searched our records under your name for any felony convictions in St. Louis County. There are no felony convictions in this county. A complaint charging burglary was filed August 11, 1964 in municipal court. The City of Duluth imposed in court. Municipal Court, City of Duluth. Enclosed, you will find copies of all relevant documents, court file 10808. Our records reflect no conviction in this matter. The case was dismissed on March 8, 1965.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Mr. Aquino a question?
Mr. Endicke?
All of that has happened in the past. What are people doing to you now that is the basis of your claim?
What I am getting at here is that there was no reason for anything. There was no reason for any kind of law enforcement in the union, all these years, and in the years close to or beyond 1974 and 75, these two people, they knew that I didn't do anything wrong. I know that there. I know that I didn't do anything wrong when the case was dismissed. Now, being in St. Peter is one thing. Being away is one thing. But for a person to come back when they have been found innocent of the charge, an allegation does not mean that a person is guilty. There are a lot of people who, in other words, around this country, who have to be treated as they're guilty, even though they were charged with a crime, and even though they're not, in other words, guilty of the crime. And the thing is, that can mess up employment matters. Like, there was an employment matter back in 1980.
Mr. Tino?
Yes.
Well, we agree with you on that. I don't think there's any disagreement on that. What is it that has happened to bring a claim against the state of Minnesota at this time? What have state employees done, or what have the state employees or the state done that has caused you to bring the claim?
Well, okay. What I'm saying is that when the state of Minnesota, when someone brings a claim against the state, like I do, and I was basically successful at that claim, even though it was, in other words, the amount of money was for being down there for 4 years for something that I, for 1,509 days for something that I didn't do. And anyway, the thing is, all the law enforcement, especially up in that county, and especially in that area, should have been notified, hey, if you do anything to bother anyone that's been accused of a crime and has been cleared of it, and you keep on trying to harass or trying to keep on using the person because of their false incarceration, there's going to be some doing. In other words, they're going to have to answer to the state of Minnesota. And basically, that's what has happened in the 7 years that have passed. This so happens I have been, and in these last years, I have been on Social Security disability. And the reason that I'm on Social Security disability is for this year, the first reason was epilepsy. And the second reason, which came out of this year, was the emotional disability because of all this.
What is the type of harassment that the state has been involved with that you have a claim against this for?
Well, when a person, like I said before, when a person has been away and tries to find a job, and they can turn that into a circus and take it to court, and although two commissioners of the State Department of Human Rights agreed with me, two commissioners of the State of Minnesota Department of Human Rights agreed with me that, in other words, I was wrong according to the laws of the State of Minnesota. Nevertheless, still the court says otherwise, and they do not. Did you want to, sir?
Mr. Chair, let me just try to focus on what's happening now. What your problem actually seems to be is that St. Louis County deputies and Duluth police and the city have harassed you in some way, and the city of Duluth has not given you jobs that you sought. Is that pretty much it?
Well, I'm not looking for employment at this point,
mm-hmm.
with the city of Duluth. But I am saying that as entities of the state of Minnesota, they're not acting very, you could say professional, by not reading the record that stated that the case was been dismissed. I received, these are monies. And many years ago, this year should have been basically a dead issue. But the thing is, they kept on, and so forth. And therefore, they were basically wrong in doing so.
And the $39,000 claim is because of?
Well, okay, the $39,000 claim would be, 1968 to now, which is, if I'm not right, that's the $39,000 claim. And in other words, in all these few years, and I've seen problems with the Minnesota State Employment Service several times through the years. And there was no reason why that should have been. And anyway, the thing is, they basically stated, when I told them basically what happened, they said, well, we don't think that our clients would want to deal with anyone like you, which I remember that. And so that was basically ended right there, because the person asked about what's this 4-year gap all about. And I told him. And I told him what happened. And I told him that it was cleared up in court. Well, when things are cleared up in court, then I think that the people in society should have enough brains and should have enough sense to realize that if this has been cleared up in court and this person has been found not guilty, or in other words, if the case was dismissed and a restoration of capacity petition was granted, there's got to be a reason for that. But these here people are basically, they think that in their minds, they can basically do whatever they want to do. Well, that's in itself tantamount to their own type of wrongdoing. And if anybody has lived up in Duluth, or anybody knows the history of that town, wrongdoing is not foreign to those people up there.
All right. I think that we will need to take a look into some of these issues. That will take us a little time to do that. Are there any questions of committee members?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Otino, it seems to me that you have been grieved but your remedy for addressing the grievance is not the state of Minnesota and the claims committee. Seems to me that it's the, I assume that the county of commitment originally was St. Louis County. And I
that was the place where all these things first started.
Sure.
But anyway, the thing is, as a result of my being away in a state facility.
Okay.
These year, in other words, these year things came about little by little by little. Time to time.
We've got the picture.
Yep.
Let's come in.
Just please be advised that the partnership that exists between state government and local units of government is very sometimes entertaining, complicated arrangement. And while you do appear to have been grieved, it would be more appropriate, in my judgment, based on what I've seen so far, that you deal with the local authorities.
Why don't we get the some comments from the Department of Human Services? Would you like to come up to the table, please, and introduce yourself?
My name is Ngozi Tupu-Akobite. I'm the Department of Human Services. And we are going to say the same thing, that it appears the claim is against law enforcement and not against the Department of Human Services. While I do not represent the law enforcement authorities, the records indicate that the charges he was alluding to occurred sometime in 1964, and they were actually dropped because he was found incompetent to stand trial.
Okay. Ms. Akabuke, would you please sign the witness sheet too while you're there? Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions from members? Okay, we'll take this case under advisement and review our decision.
I just want to add that the charges that were made were dropped, and St. Louis County will have a record of that there.
Yep.
And the
we've got that right here.
The charges were dropped because there was insufficient evidence, according to the record, according to the court, to find any charges that the police made on the burglary charge.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Okino, from what I can tell from the material that you submitted, it appears that presently the law enforcement agencies or the record keeping agencies do not have records of any even any charges. Is that right?
That's what Cindy Stradioli did say, but there are people in St. Louis County in Duluth. We do know that I was down. They do know that I was down in St. Peter for that period of time.
But in terms of official records, it appears at least as of today, there are no longer any records relating to the arrest and conviction maintained by either the FBI, which gathers information from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, as part of the Criminal Justice Information System, or the St. Louis County District Court appears to have no convictions on there, but we have apparently records relating to the initial charges and what was done with them. Basically, so, are you somehow contending that these records are improperly maintained, or that they were somehow kept when they should not have been kept? Or
I guess you could say the record should have reflected right away what Kimberly Del Greco finally did. She contacted the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, where the sum was prior to August 17th of 2005. Now that's 74, 94, 94, that's probably 39 years later or so, somewhere around in that area, or 41 years, 40 years later, whatever. And anyway, they cleared up at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that, in other words, the charge, in other words, no such charges did exist. They took that off the books then. But it should have been taken off the books right away in 1974. And of course, in 1975, that claim was reflected, which I have here. It was reflected in the laws of the state of Minnesota in 1975. So therefore, I was, in other words, I was right to begin with. But the thing is, like I said before, when a person tries to find work, I have tried state agencies. I have tried, in other words, I should say the state agencies. I mean the state employment service, and then there was a job with the city, which the personnel director, who happens to be a friend of this person that I know, Gerald Haney. And anyway, he told me about that there's a new job. It was called Alternatives to Testing, and that there was basically a test for employment.
Senator Glass.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Aquino, I've got the letter that you're referring to from Kimberly Del Greco from the FBI, and it appears that that they were maintaining some information in their files, basically an arrest entry and a fingerprint card that they had received from the Minnesota BCA, and when they received a request from the Minnesota BCA to destroy and delete those records, they did so. And that was done in August of 2005. Have you made any specific requests for expungement of records or filed any motion in district court for expungement of any records under the state expungement law prior to that time?
Mr. Aquino.
After, I never made any kind of a motion for expungement, because I was always under the impression that when a person is found not guilty or when the case has been dismissed, that automatically expunges the case.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lack.
That may point out some problems with the dissemination of to the general public, the people involved in the criminal justice system, about the availability of the expungement remedy under state statute. It is in fact to state that the arrest records and what happens with a case, even if ultimately acquitted, do remain typically part of the criminal justice record system, unless and until there's an expungement request and a motion granted by a judge to do that. But let me ask you a follow-up question, if I might, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any indication that the records maintained by any of these entities, for whatever period of time they maintain them, that those records specifically cost you a job or area? You said there are people who knew about the situation, but in terms of records and background checks, any indication they have specifically caused you any direct harm?
Well, I know what you're saying, and as far as any records being kept, you're probably gonna keep a record, like the sheriff up there. When I talked to him one time, he said right away, he says, well, basically, he says, we thought you were guilty of that there, and he says, in other words, although the case was dismissed. Now, I don't even care what they think. I mean, I know what happened exactly. And even this year, lady, was involved with this year, with this accusation, she admitted that no, he did not take anything from the house whatsoever.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Aquino, unfortunately, we can't sit here today as a jury from the burglary case. And time passed, and unfortunately, it's hard to erase people's memories. All we can do here is try to deal with state issues. So you've answered my question, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, we'll now have Representative Atkins. take the McEachern case, Minnesota Department of Transportation, please.
Good afternoon. Harrison Materials. By the way, in your package, I believe that the go to this matter.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's my pleasure to be here with Pastor John and Judy McEachern from Invergrove Heights. They are the one mistake I made in this summary document for you is that I called them Lutheran. They're Methodist. So otherwise, I believe that the factual basis. Well, they pointed it out to me.
Well, that changes everything.
But thank you very much for the opportunity. This has been hanging over their heads for not just months, but literally years. So it's nice to finally get to this point in time. If I were to pour poison in your yard, even if by accident, I would feel responsibility to help clean it up. And that's essentially what took place here. The state, and we don't allege that they did it with any intent or any malice, but back in 1982, they demolished the bridge, and it had asbestos on it. It was buried in what came to later be the McEachern's yard. That was in 1982. Since then, and by the way, the McEachern's weren't anywhere near it at the time. They were living down in St. Peter back then. They only came to own that property in 1999, so literally 15 years later. By then, the property had changed hands several times over. And when they went to start construction, went through the whole process, got a permit to build a single-family home, and they started digging, and lo and behold, they found that bridge, which contained asbestos. And it required a costly cleanup. There have been all sorts of efforts to try to mitigate that expense as much as possible. The city has contributed a portion of the cost. They worked with the county and with the state MPCA to bring down a cost originally estimated at over $140,000 down to about $82,000. And that is the amount that the county spent to clean up the site and eventually then has assessed against the McEachern. We just a few days ago actually received the response. It'd be MnDOT because it was a bridge, and I know the volume, by the way, of number of claims that you have. So we have endeavored to try to put in a single page a summary of the claim, the chronology that I just kind of walked through quickly. But as far as we can tell, there's three arguments that MnDOT makes for not wanting to take responsibility. One is they say it wasn't a state bridge. In fact, and in your materials, as well as the fact that Pastor McEachern and I have both spoken directly with a fellow by the name of Charlie Keenan, he responded to a newspaper article that he read, called the Dakota County Attorney's Office. You'll see that record. He also talked with John. He talked with myself as recently as 2 days ago. MnDOT calls into question a bit his credibility, that he wasn't quite sure what bridge it was. He says absolutely 100%. Over and over, and he was certain of it, that it was a state project. It was a state bridge that literally he drove from the I-494 project, which is about 4 miles away, and he deposited in what came to be the McEachern's yard. Just to be sure of that, because MnDOT alleged that there might have been other bridges, city, county bridges, or something like that, so we checked around. There were no other bridges. Check with the mayor, check with the county commissioner, check with the public works director. I also grew up 3 blocks away, and there simply are no other city or county bridges. The only bridge that was demolished at the time was the state bridge at Highway 3, Robert Street, is what you're probably familiar with, Robert Street and Highway 110. That bridge was taken down. It was delivered by Mr. Keenan to these poor folks' yard. MnDOT's second contention is that the material tested from their yard was something other than the bridge pilings that contain the asbestos. And as John will tell you, as their, and we've got their environmental consultant, who's also an architect, his notes are under, I guess it would be the violet or purple tab in your materials. All of them have identified that it was, in fact, those. By the way, the problem is that they look like pipes. So in the testing records, they said that they were testing pipes. They are, in fact, bridge pilings. And John and the photographs and Mr. Havager and everybody says that the material, in fact, tested were those black, round, cylindrical items that were found that are, in fact, bridge pilings. And I'm told that apparently the reason why they coat those, and by the way, I would reference you to, I won't go through and read all of the Mr. Havager's comments, but he talks about how it literally could not have been anything else. He talks about ductile iron, water mains is brittle, it can't be bent, these in fact were bent. He talks about there's no evidence of any other building-related debris on the site. In fact, you'll see in the photographs, there are giant chunks of this bridge, man-sized chunks. There's a fellow standing there. This is obviously a bridge right next to, in proximity to those, where these bridge pilings. And I'm going to let these nice folks testify to that effect or to that point. But it's in fact bridge pilings that were tested by this firm. And they were found to contain asbestos. They were the state bridge pilings that were brought from the Highway 110 and Robert Street Bridge. The final point that MnDOT makes is that there's not been an exhaustion of administrative and judicial remedies, and we've addressed that in our materials to you as well. They have literally tried everything. They've made a claim against the city and got some funds there. They worked with the county, and that was reduced eventually by over $60,000. They tried to bring a claim against with Mendota Homes, the seller of the property, and that was rebuffed by the Department of Labor and Industry, that there was not an obligation at the time. The other, obviously, very apparent issue is that much of this is barred by the statute of limitations. These actions took place in 1982. These folks were not in privity with any of the people that own the property. They weren't even in the community in 1982, so most of those claims are all gone. And even if they weren't barred, many of them by the statute of limitations, finding evidence and witnesses for situations that took place 25 years ago make it impractical, if not impossible, to pursue a claim. So they have pursued and exhausted every potential remedy within reason, and that is why they now sit here before you today. And with that, unless there's questions instantly for me, I would turn over to either Pastor John or Pastor Judy McEachran.
I just have a clarifying question I'd like to ask. The claim is for 82,000, I believe, and it. But according to the timeline here, it appears that the city has paid some dollars since then. So, what is the current claim?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. The amount assessed was the $82,346. That was dates back to when the claim was submitted in February. Since that time, they have the city has paid $15,000, so you can take off $15,000 from what the original claim was.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record.
I'm John McEachran.
Judy McEachran.
And thank you for being here today and allowing us to be here and hearing our claim. It has been something that we never expected, never planned for, and still feel unprepared for as we went through this. We bought property. We got ideas to build a house. We went through the process of splitting a lot, working with the city planners. We got a building permit, and I still remember the day that I got home from the church and the excavator was on site digging the basement, and he had stopped, and the contractor ran up to me and says, "We got a bridge." And they had unearthed these huge chunks of concrete that you have pictures of. And either, I would say most of the chunks of concrete are at least as big as a table. Maybe bigger. Some of them were bigger than that. And you can see from the pictures some indication as to the size of the bridge.
And in addition to that, it's all of this material is from a basement that's about 35 by 35. So it's not a huge area, you know, it was all close together as it was excavated. And when I first saw the bridge pilings, I too thought they were just big hunks of pipe. But I've heard of bridge pilings and I've heard pile drivers, but I didn't know what a bridge piling was. But in some study and consultation with some experts, these were identified as bridge pilings. And then part of the process of the county's inspection and the MPCA's inspection was to look at these pipes, and there were two of them, and there are pictures of the pipes, and then also back beyond the blue section, there's a handwritten, this is from Jackie Benin, who works for the MPCA, and she there says sample taken 1 and 2 at the bottom of the page, the pipe coating 10 foot length, 8 inch pipe. And she probably didn't know they were bridge pilings either, and called them pipes. But Chuck Habiger has assured us that these are bridge pilings, and they are part and parcel with all the other bridges that were found there.
And you did mention on the pictures that you have under the red tab, I believe that there might have been the last picture in the orange tab is one of the bridge pilings as well. And the first picture in the red section, probably that's just interchange, that could be in the previous section. But then you'll see the one larger picture, the second picture in the red, is one of the pipes, and you can see the black mastic coating a little bit there. But the next picture is an enlargement of that with the black mastic coating on it, which is the problem.
And that's what was tested by the MPCA lab, Terratech, and also the EPA lab tested that material. And that's the conclusive evidence that we have for significant asbestos. And I remember when Jackie Denise saw those pipes, she said that's enough for her. Between those two bridge pilings, that's enough for her to say that there's asbestos on site.
And without having that problem, the cleanup of just this large chunk of concrete would not nearly have been the expense. So when it becomes the asbestos related, that's where the trouble for expenses comes to us pursuing the property owners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John and Judith, I assume you're on the municipal water system rather than your own well.
Yeah.
In the analysis of the asbestos on the property, have they described for you negative impacts on the aquifer, on the soil, the danger that the asbestos pilings would pose to the community at large?
Well, the effort of the county and the city was to clean our site,
okay,
and to make it not a problem. So they did not only come in and take away the excavated material, the bridge abutments and the bridge pilings and all the excavated dirt, but they also, once they took out all the material, went down 2 feet, and then they put down a geotextile fabric as a barrier. And then we paid for the, and we already did it, we paid for the 2 feet of fill to carry on top of that.
Okay.
But we believe that the cleanup was thorough and adequate.
Senator Oakley?
You mentioned that you had split property. How big of an area was this? That was obviously just a portion of the bridge. So was the whole bridge disposed there, or was just the area where you excavated for your basement cleaned up?
McEachern.
I don't know if there's more bridge material there buried. I think that the county environmental department's effort is if there is more bridge and other material, if that stay buried and not be brought to the surface, and that's what that material being brought to the surface is what caused the concern. Am I answering your question?
Other questions? Senator Lyons.
I got a number of questions that maybe I should ask if there's any further presentations that might have to come in before I ask them.
Well, I did want to say that I did talk to the truck driver, Charles Conan, and he assured me that he did bring bridge to our yard. I had the excavator and the contractor identify it as bridge material. And we took pictures to try to support that and try to explain it. Additionally, in relationship to the involvement of different agencies in the testing, the two bridge pilings that were unearthed by the excavation were tested in the in your material is the results of those tests, but that's where the asbestos primarily came from.
I don't know if Councilor Representative Atkins or Gackens can answer these questions, whoever feels that suited. This one's probably best for the attorney in front of us. With regard to the statute of limitations question, I haven't done the research on this. You know, is this an occurrence rule, or would this be a discovery rule on here?
It's a good question, Mr. Chair. Senator Lance, the first point I have to make is that I'm here in my capacity as a representative. I meant to make that at the outset. As opposed to counsel, there is no attorney-client relationship here. As proud as I would be to represent these folks, I am here as their state representative, which is basically nice way to say, I ain't charging them anything for this. I'm sure they appreciate that very much. To answer your question specifically, there are we literally tried to look for every conceivable remedy under the sun. Some are in a current base. Negligence claims, that sort of thing, obviously are under that category. Fraud is the discovery base. And we looked at that. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to prove that anyone intentionally, and we're not representing, by the way, that NINDOT or anyone else, intentionally misled these poor folks. What occurred is that they put a poison in their yard. They didn't intend to do it at the time, but now it's a matter of everybody taking some responsibility for it. So we have not been able to, other than the claims that they have in fact pursued, that would enable them to pursue any other claims, administrative, judicial, or otherwise.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chairman, was there any testing done on the site? I mean, I understand that there was discovery of asbestos coating on these pipes. But was there any testing done on the site to determine if that asbestos showed up anywhere other than attached to the pipes?
Yes. I think the company's name is Paratech or Paratech. Their report is there. And then there's some, I think it's in here, from the county where they said there was significant amounts of asbestos. But as far as what was tested was a few pieces of transite, which is house siding, and then these pipes. And the bigger percentage of the asbestos that was discovered by the labs was from the pipes, or the bridge pilings, I think, well, bridge pilings.
Mr. Chairman, it seemed to me, if I recall from reading some of the material, that there was some question as to whether or not there was a dispute, perhaps, as to how extensive any contamination might have been and whether or not the scope of the cleanup was overextended and therefore more extensive than might have been necessary to deal with this particular level and scope of contamination. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Very amateurish thought. I don't know what might have been done differently as far as the cleanup. It seemed like, you know, we didn't have any options or choices to what extent there would be a cleanup. We were just told by MPCA and by the county it's going to be this way. And when they talked about removing 2 feet after they took out all the excavated material going down another 2 feet, we didn't have any choice in that. And I guess my hope was that they did what was necessary. And the way they were going through it, I was sure I was asking questions. How much is here? Where is it? To what extent do we have to do this cleanup? But it's after the fact now, they did it.
To that point, if I may,
I asked that very question of the county, and they said that they did the most cost-effective job that they could safely do in order to address the problem. I mean, they didn't do anything beyond what needed to be done, but they, in order to make it safe, a safe site, this is what they needed to do.
Mr. Chairman, one reason I raised the question is because it sounds like there was the stuff that had been excavated, discovered by excavation, was removed, but there was other material on site, which apparently was deemed to be okay to leave that in place, it sounds like, rather than excavate and remove that material. So it kind of raises a disconnect.
Well, and to that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Lansterson, I'm sorry, I keep promoting you back to representative. I wish, actually, that we were perhaps joined by the county, because that point also came up. I'm sure John and Judy can address it as well. But they said, actually, with asbestos, some of it left undisturbed. That's the best thing, and I see Representative Anselt must have encountered that at some point, but that's the best approach. Is don't disturb it once it has been disturbed. And obviously, had they known it was there at the outset, they wouldn't have gone digging in the yard, and none of this would have come about. But once disturbed, then you have to address it, and that's exactly what they did to the extent needed, and the rest they remained or left undisturbed.
So the photo of that in our booklet here that show the pipes exposed, was that after excavation the pipes were lifted and placed on the ground?
That was part of the excavation. Those things were uncovered and unearthed, and they were found buried in the area where the house was built. And so, to build a house, you have to unearth them and move them out.
Mr. Chairman,
sure. Like,
so what was the total cleanup cost then that was involved? And I understand what you claim was about $82,000, but what was the total cleanup cost?
The total cost was 143,000, rounding that off. And additionally, we paid more for landscaping than we typically would have, and more for driveway than we typically would have, in an effort to provide closure and cleanup. And we spent of our own funds about $30,000 in addition to that.
Mr. Chairman?
All right.
So what you're saying is the county originally incurred the cleanup cost for the county, the MPCA, and then the county has agreed or chose not to seek reimbursement to recover from you of about $60,000 of that?
Senator West, $60,000, that total cost is reduced by was reduced by what's called supplemental environmental projects, and that was through the MPCA, and the county worked with them to those funds, as I understand it, come from contractors and businesses that have been fined or have had a problem with the MPCA, and they do this work and their fines are reduced. So it's like a public service type thing. And part of the issue is, as we work through this, we're working with the county, and we have the notice of violation, and we appealed that, and we went through the process with the county commissioners, was the hope that these SEPs, supplemental environmental projects, that there would be enough funds within those to take care of the entire cost. And we had letters from our county commissioner saying we're doing everything to try to make it so that there's no cost to you, or very little cost to you in this cleanup. We were really optimistic. We got calls from a representative from the MPCA saying, you know, we're you won't have to pay hardly anything. We have reset, and that'll cover it. But then when we got to the point of signing the agreement with the county, they said, there's not as much money there as we thought. And so this is the residual amount.
And was there any reason, Mr. Chairman, was there any reason to believe that the county itself, by virtue of any of its involvement there, should have absorbed some of the cost?
Senator Lassen, Mr. Chairman, trying to get this right. We certainly held that hope, and they did. One of the things they did is there's a tax called a tipping fee when the debris is taken to a landfill, and the county collects a tipping fee, a tax on that, and they did take that off. And then, in addition to that, during the cleanup, there was county staff at work a lot, and they were supervising and directing, and they waived, as I understand it, they waived the cost of that. This was, just working from a foggy memory, something over $20,000.
I'm not sure that I thought they were paying for the asbestos inspector fee, which was quite substantial, and when they took the dirt away, they had to have an inspector for asbestos on hire for all the hours. I'm not sure, but I think they had talked about covering that cost for the inspector.
One other question I might know, if I think of anything else. I'll let some others have questions down. Is your claim basically that MnDOT, not that they intentionally dumped that asbestos on the site, but that MnDOT was responsible for intentionally dumping this material on that particular site? There was clearly an intervening contractor there that did the hauling and the dumping, and the agreement was, did the contractor choose the location to dump the site? Did the contractor have any involvement there, separate and apart from ability to prove liability, you know, for a legal action, statute of limitations, or something like that? But is MnDOT only the owner here, or does MnDOT have some involvement in the improper disposal of this material that you're aware of?
Representative Atkin.
Senator Lassen.
Obviously, it's been 25 years, so we can't say exactly, but we do know that it was a state project, it was a state contract. As I understand state contracts, they have a pretty wide swath in terms of what they control, including payment for, to the extent they were having it hauled and dumped somewhere, they were paying for that as well. And what I would suggest to you is it's no different than if, I used the analogy early on, if I poured poison in your yard, albeit unintentionally, I would feel some sense of responsibility for that, regardless whether it's your yard, like McEachran's here with that site and the hauler poured it on their yard, or Representative Osment's or Representative Anselt's, whatever yard it ended up in, regardless of who hauled it or how it got there, I own it and I have some responsibility for it. Everybody in the course of this has tried to step up and take some responsibility, including McEachran's, who incurred another $30,000 or so in cost directly to them. And the goal here is just to have the state bear its fair share as the owner of what came to be dumped in what was eventually in the McEachran's yard.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the witnesses, one of the opportunities of serving on this committee is to get to learn a little about everything in state government. I know in the record that back in 1984, the MPCA was involved and knew that this was a landfill, and there was correspondence about needing to cap it. I don't see the results of them supervising and signing off on the capping of it. And so I'm wondering if that was actually even done. But second of all, my understanding was always that was the whole purpose of the Superfund funding mechanism, was to go in and clean up pollution and then, you know, later straighten out whether or not you could go to the responsible parties. And was there an effort ever by the city of Invergrove Heights or the county or the state to look into that process for this particular site.
Actually, I know this chair, Representative Loeffler, that was to the witnesses, but I know the answer, which is that we have been over backwards. I've been involved in it for longer than I care to say. It's probably 3 years now. We have asked everybody to exhaust every remedy before we ever came here. And it's, you know, county, city, these nice folks, Mr. Havenshire, members of MPCA, everybody has looked at the possibility, and Superfund has come up repeatedly, and apparently, I'm no Superfund expert, but apparently this site is not eligible for some reason. It was eligible for supplemental environmental projects, but I guarantee you everything they could find, they did find before they came here to ask for the owner of the asbestos to take some level of responsibility.
Using that answer as a little bit of a segue here, it sure seems to me that the public health agency in this case, the Dakota County Environmental Health folks, they did their job. PCA did their job. The homeowners have done more than they should have been asked. And that leads me to either the state agency involved, which is MnDOT, or whomever MnDOT may have contracted with to dispose of the material. And factoring in 25 years and statute of limitations and everything else, it just points me in one direction, and that's back to MnDOT.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Alfields, if I might, these folks aren't in privity with the deliverer,
yeah,
with the trucking, so they can't pursue that. That's for MnDOT to try to pursue, yeah, if they opt for that, I guess. It's very difficult at this point to pursue that. So they've pursued everything they can before they came to this group here.
Another question. I think we're ready to see what the response is for MnDOT.
Well, yeah. But I was just reading through part of MnDOT's response. Maybe I should wait for that. But are you pursuing action? Because it talks about the transit sewer connection pipe and the water main pipes. Would they have been part of the bridge project that the bridge pilings were from? Or would they have been from some other? Is there any way to find out where they were from?
Chair, Senator Olsen, I think what I would do is reference you to the purple tab, where it, even though the testing agencies were referring to pipe, the only thing that was at issue were in fact bridge pilings, and they described for you why they couldn't have been other types of pipe, that in fact they were bridge pilings. So there's that combined with the fact that we're talking about 25 years and the fact that all of this was found in proximity to the bridge. You're talking when Pastor McEachran talks about 35 by 35, you're talking about a space smaller actually than this room with all these big giant chunks of bridge plus the bridge pilings that are right amidst them. So it's pretty darning evidence that these were in fact part of the bridge.
A follow-up, if I may?
Hunter?
MnDOT claims that if it was from the 110 bridge, they would have been wood piling. Has anybody investigated the plans of that bridge, if there are plans that showed if they were wood pilings or steel pilings or whatever kind of pilings were used?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, we are not the keeper of those records. Our friends from MnDOT, and we assume that if they had records, they would have produced them. What we do have is the fact that the only bridge that was worked on as part of the 494 project, literally the only bridge period, was that state bridge at Highway 110 and 494. So where else it could have come from, it just simply, there is nowhere else that it could have come from.
So, Mr. Chair, could I just ask one question? Because I'm curious about this transite siding. It's clear that there was some of that, and that it did have some asbestos. How much of that was there?
And I'll let Pastor John talk about it. I know that he said, and other folks have all said that the vast majority was from the bridge piling, but that was where the chief amount of asbestos was found, but apparently there was some found on some siding as well. But John?
Yes, and that's correct, that Jackie Demeen from MPCA, who was the inspector that came to the site, did focus not on the tronsite siding, but upon those bridge pilings and the coating upon them. And when she saw those, she said, that's enough. Don't need anything else to justify the cleanup. However, the county, Dakota County Environmental, did find some tronsite and Terratech. In their testing, they had some small amounts of tronsite siding as well.
Okay, other questions? Yes,
Mr. Chairman. Senator Lyons. I'm looking at the Tetra Tech report from June 30, 2005, with the sample analytical results, and maybe you can clarify for me if I'm not reading it accurately. But it looked to me like they took 8 soil samples from different sites around the area, 8 composite soil samples labeled EPA 1 from EPA 8. And I assume ND, the results for those different samples were ND, not detected above laboratory reporting limits for asbestos. Apparently there was some DRO. I'm not sure what the DRO is.
Diffusorange organic.
Okay, is that hazardous of any sort? Is that a concern?
Mr. Haniger told us that in those levels it's not considered hazardous.
So it looks like from Tetra Tech's analysis here that the only place where asbestos contamination was found was actually on the transit siding and on the pipe coating. Am I reading that the same way that you are?
I think that's actually correct. And it's 4 times the level on the bridge pile, the pipe coating. As opposed to the transite. It looks like it's 55% asbestos on the pipe coating in the lower right corner there versus 12% on the siding.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm asking the question kind of goes back to my earlier question about the scope of the cleanup that was conducted. I know the city had initially taken a look at it and said, wait, we've got to look at this, and we said, it's not a big deal, go ahead and continue just remove these materials. And then the county or the MPCA later came in and said, wait a second, you've got to go through this $100,000 plus cleanup. And I guess I'm asking why. And maybe there's just some standard protocol that is followed regardless of what the extent of any actual contamination is. What it looks like from the actual field samples that there wasn't any asbestos contamination anywhere on the site in the soil. It was just connected to the particular materials, the transite siding and the pipe coat. And if that's the case, why wouldn't it have been enough simply to remove those materials from the site and not have to excavate 2 feet and put in the special textile barrier and everything else?
Mr. Chairman, Senator West, do you know how many times that question came up?
That very question was posed, but we're not, nobody here are the experts, and the experts were at the county and with the MPCA, and they were the ones that said this must be done. And I gathered from what they said is that once you take it out of the ground and it becomes exposed, it spreads around and you've got to clean up this whole site. And so they took that action. It was the point very much came up. But at this point, I think that's a better question for perhaps the county, the MPCA. But they were absolutely certain, without a doubt, that this was the minimum amount of work that needed to be done in order to safely secure this site.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, part of the question I'm raising is whether or not the county, maybe the MPCA, which is an agency of the state, will be connected to this as well. But as well, the county has absorbed some costs, apparently, in this, but I'm wondering if they should be absorbing more of the $82,000 remaining claim than they appear to have already absorbed. I don't know if they're in a position to respond to that now. But
the only
brief response to the chair of Center Labs. They would almost, I think their number that they say they've absorbed in staff costs and testing costs and abatement or landfill fees is actually greater than the amount of the remaining claim. The remaining claim now is about $67,000. If you add up all that the county indicates that they've done, I think it adds up to actually more than that. So while it's a good point, I think if they were sitting here, they would be jumping up and down telling us how they've been over backwards trying to address that very issue.
Mr. Chairman, that was not included in the $142,000
cost.
Is that right?
That's correct. It would be even beyond that, nor did the put in that additional $30,000 that they've incurred. So everybody's got skin in the game at this point other than literally the owner of the asbestos, which is the state of Minnesota.
Representative Manziel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and Senator Lask specifically. Knowing you as I do, Senator Lask, I know that you're concerned about groundwater and contamination and environmental degradation as I am, but coming from northern Minnesota and the mining country, we know a little bit about asbestos. We know a little bit about asbestos-like fibers, which is a mining company-contrived term. And we're going to learn a lot more. But my point is that the Public Health Agency went to the nth degree, I believe, looking at the documents to preserve and protect the ground and the water and the aquifer and every other possibility here. And we've learned that what may be a contained, contaminated site today may not be a contained site decades from now. So I'm not as concerned about the cost of all of this as you seem to be. But I am concerned about fairness and getting on with this.
Okay. Any other questions?
If I might just respond, I am concerned about cost, Representative Manziel, but I also ask a lot of questions to try to flesh out the whole scope of the issue before reaching a conclusion about it. So I wouldn't necessarily project my decision on this by the questions that I'm asking.
Yeah, point well made. It's a great reference. Awesome.
Mr. Chairman, and perhaps this will go to the representative or the witnesses could respond if that's more appropriate. In our packet is an agreement that was done on the 8th of October of this year, so relatively recently, with a settlement with the city for $15,000. And, you know, I think there's, we kind of are the train, the caboose at the end of the train that's been moving along, and so we always have to review the history and why we ended up where we ended up with a hole that the state has asked to fill. And given that it was the city of Embergrove Heights that, you know, dealt with the landfill, platted this property as appropriate for residential, permitted, you know, issued residential permits, it seems like there's some responsibility from the city. Since they knew it was a landfill, they'd been involved in it before the houses were even introduced into that area. $15,000 seems like a relatively small amount of money, but I'm just wondering if you could share with us in the negotiations, you know, how did that figure come up, and leaving the rest to us now here in November.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler. The single most important point I can make is the claim was actually denied by the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust. It was submitted. They sent back a memo essentially claiming sovereign immunity and a variety of other defenses that are very sound defenses for the city. Nonetheless, the city council, the mayor and city council, in spite of that observation from their legal counsel, still negotiated with the McEachrans on their own and eventually came to the $15,000 figure. If I can add to this, if I were sitting here in my capacity as a lawyer And I suspect that Senator Lassen is in his lawyer capacity, or lawyer Lindecki would tell you the same thing. I wouldn't want to be bringing this claim against the city. It was they had about this much of a role in it relative to everybody else, and I suspect that the likelihood of prevailing in that claim. I say this now, by the way, that they settled the claim, but I wouldn't even take the call. Because these are nice people, but I wouldn't take the case in a million years. And I, if need be happy to supply you with that Lincoln, Minnesota City's insurance denial. But to pursue that claim, I would venture to say would cost probably in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $100,000 in experts and trial and court costs for the likelihood of getting probably nothing in return because of the defenses that a city can avail itself of. But they pursued it nonetheless. They got $15,000, and if they hadn't pursued it, I guarantee our friends from MnDOT would come here, and I mean that, by the way. They'd probably tell you they should have pursued it. So they did. They got a little something, way more than I would have ever anticipated, but they got $15,000.
Question. Mr. Lindy, do you have a question? Okay, we'll go to MnDOT testimony. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Stick around. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I am here for you. My name is Mike Ligard, and I am the claims and construction support engineer for MnDOT. So my job is primarily to be a source of information for our project engineers and our project supervisors. And I also handle our construction plans. So I deal with our contractors when they have disputes during our construction project. I guess the first thing, from my point of view, I have a letter that was written, there was an email from Mrs. McEachern to Dakota County, so certainly we want to say we recognize the ordeal that the McEacherns have gone through. I mean, this has been quite an issue for them to work through, and the issue is incredibly complex because when I went through Dakota County documents and City of Inver Grove Heights documents, I mean, there's no less than eight parties that have been involved just in the documents that I reviewed trying to, figure out the piling and if, there was asbestos related to piling. So,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman, do you reject the notion that there was asbestos associated with the pilings?
Well, I guess what I'm going to bring forth is discussions that I had with our bridge office trying to get our arms around this. Like the council comment in the first case, I mean, these jobs are a long time ago. And MnDOT works with a 7-year retention on our records. And so we were really at a loss as far as being able to go back and get our boxes and the like. And 7-year retention is what we've utilized for many years for retention of our construction documents. So I guess what I would, in an opening, what I would like to say, it is a very complex issue, but I believe the fact that I'm going to give you would give it a fairly straightforward outcome as far as our point of view, as far as MnDOT's point of view. I guess I would start with the core and the core of the claim, and I believe you guys did talk about this with the maker, just repeating a little bit, but the core really is the cleanup of asbestos and everything that went along with the cleanup of asbestos. I guess the one point that I would make is that during the testing, it didn't appear to us that any road or bridge more on the concrete rebar, soil type road or bridge material was tested. The claim lists three sources of asbestos, and the first one was the transite sewer connection plates. And when I read that, I was a little confused, and I think. It was maybe just a little bit of a mistake because I was wondering if they meant pipe tile or siding tile, and I think they really meant siding tile, not not the the pipe tile of the water draining pipe tile. And then the claim says there was mastic coating on water main pipe, and then the claim says that there was mastic coating on bridge piling from I-494 construction demolition between 1979 and 1984. And we are going to contend that there was no mastic coating on piling, and this is maybe the long way around the way, and I apologize for that. We're going to contend that there was no mastic coating on the piling because the piling on the bridges that we would have been demolishing along that 494 corridor were in fact wood, and they would have been treated with creosote or creosote. That would have been the era. But maybe just to back up one step before I go into that part of it, I did talk with Charles Keenan, and I wouldn't necessarily, sitting in front of you now, say that, you know, that I would. Here's what I heard from Charlie. I called him, and I don't have anything in writing, but I can tell you what I heard. When I talked to Charlie, in the claim it said they hauled in 82 or 83. Charlie just loosened that up a little bit, and he said he couldn't remember if it was exactly 82 or 83, but he said it was in the early 80s. So we're still in that ballpark. And then he changed the location from where he thought the material came from the 110, excuse me, the 110, 494, Robert Street 52 area. And he moved it over to the east a little bit, over to Booth Avenue. Well, Booth Avenue at that time was actually an at-grade intersection. It came down and it teed into Highway 110, and we were building a bridge there under the construction projects, but we weren't demoing the bridge there. It's now Blaine Avenue, I think, in 1983, or thereabouts, they changed the name of it. So while, you know, Charlie's information really didn't give us a lot more to go on as far as which, you know, bridges or which projects to focus on. In your packet, we have several exhibits, and I apologize for the number of them, but, you know, we felt that it was important to try and get you as much information as we could. The first exhibit, and this is maybe just another clue of MnDOT being involved in construction at this time, because we certainly don't deny that we had construction projects going on in the early 80s along 494. We did. We had a lot of them. The exhibit A that you have on page 2, and it's exhibit A is a memo to a file from Dakota County, and Ron Schmidt was the owner of the land at that time, and it was basically just kind of an inspection report. And on the second page, and I took this to be probably a quote from Ron Schmidt, the landowner, to the Dakota County person, and in the second to the last paragraph, he says, for example, Linda Construction Company currently is utilizing the site for waste from demolished bridges and roads. And so, you know, with that in mind, you know, it is likely that MnDOT was dumping concrete, rebar, soil, maybe concrete pavement. I doubt asphalt pavement because Linda's primarily a bridge contractor. But the point is that when we started evaluating this, it's pretty sketchy on which job. There were several projects going on, and you'd hate to come out and say it was this contractor at this time. I mean, this was just a four example from one report, and there was another person that came forward on behalf of the McEachrans, you know, that said they felt that there was hauling. Here, I guess I would just simply like to make 3 points on behalf of MnDOT. And the first point, I sat down with our bridge office, and we talked about the bridges that we may be demolishing in that area. And what the bridge office reported to me was that the bridges that would have been demolished in that era on that project in that corridor would have been constructed on creosote preserved wood piling. And that the pipe pilings would not have been utilized. We didn't start using those until I think probably in the mid 60s to the early 70s. So,
Mr. Chair,
this kind of goes back to my previous question. Does MnDOT have the original blueprints of that bridge so that they could go in the archives and find out what exactly was the piling situation?
Yes, I believe we do.
I didn't bring any in. We just didn't really know for sure which bridge it was, and I didn't want to give you the impression that we were coming in here and saying, you know, it's this bridge, it's this piling, you know, their wood, you have to see it our way, and so maybe in the long run that hurt us, but I guess the statement I'm bringing forth to you today is that the bridge office reported to me that the piling on the bridge is in that corridor or wood, and I do believe, and I could be wrong on this, but I do believe that the bridge office keeps fairly permanent records on their structures, and so I think it is likely that you could probably search that out, or that would be something that you could look at. And actually, if you wanted to see a certain bridge, if you wanted to say, you know, it's probable that it was this bridge, you'd be able to see what kind of piling that bridge had.
Mr. Chair, just to get it totally clear, there's no question then the department doesn't dispute that there was bridge demolition stuff brought and dumped there by Lunda or somebody.
We don't have any documentation that would lead us to dispute that. When you look at the statement that was made by the McEachern's, and you look at Exhibit A, and knowing that we had a bunch of work going on, no, I don't think that we're going to draw a line in the sand and say that it is not possible that there was not concrete and rebar and, you know, another construction demolition material that was being hauled to the site. I don't think that we did.
Mr. Chair, the fact that Charlie Conan says that he hauled bridge stuff and dumped it there, that convinces you that you don't know which bridge stuff, you don't know exactly when, but you don't dispute that Charlie Conan, when he says he hauled bridge stuff there, actually dumped it on that site.
No.
Okay.
No, after my interview with him, I mean, his answers were not as crisp, if you will, with me, but, I mean, they were in that same ballpark.
So, Mr. Chair, then the only remaining question is, what stuff was it, and did it have asbestos on it? Is that pretty much it?
Is that a question to me?
Yeah.
It would, what stuff was it, and did it have asbestos, would be the remaining question.
Mr. Chair. To clarify that last question, at least in my mind, you said, what stuff was it? Did you say, who owned the stuff? I mean, was it stuff from the MnDOT bridge? Is that still under view?
Who owns the material?
Yeah. And you said, Mr. Lendicke, one question is, what stuff was it? What do you mean by that?
Mr. Chair, my question, first I wanted to establish that the department admits that some of their bridge material was dumped on that site, and that seems to be the case. And that would, and if it's their bridge material that was dumped on the site, then the question of whose stuff it was almost becomes not important. Representative Atkins tells us that there were no other bridges being built in that part of Dakota County at the time or something. But it seems clear that some state bridge stuff was dumped there. That's what Charlie said. Is that right?
Yes, I would agree with that. But I would probably qualify it with our... We're trying to assert that if the piling was wood, it was probably concrete and rebar and not any piling.
So, Mr. Chairman,
there less.
So then I understand, you're saying if there was piping
material, whatever, that had this nasty coating on that was dumped on that site, that MnDOT's position is that was not taken from a MnDOT bridge. It came there from some other source.
Actually, that would lead me into my point number two. Should I go there to see if that would answer your question? So first, I guess to recap point number one, we would really like to assert that the bridges in that area that we would have been demolishing would have fed wood piling. Point number two that I would like to bring forth is when we were going through all of the documentation, we started to ask ourselves if the core issue on this claim is asbestos. You know, when do we really see asbestos come into play? And this will be the longest point that I'll have, so please bear with me. I'm going to reference several of the exhibits. The first exhibit is back to Exhibit A, and I guess without forcing you to read it, what we noticed was that the material that they were talking about, and I would just maybe read off a few. It talked about, but let me back up just a little bit. The Exhibit A is that memo from Dakota County into the complaint file when they came and they did a visit, and I think they were starting to become concerned with Ron Schmidt's landfill. And it talked about demolition waste, concrete, brick, etc., clean earthen fill. In 84, what they really seemed to be concerned about was a grayish, dry cake sludge of unknown origin, concrete, brick, asphalt, reinforcing rod. The owner's recently burned barn, 7 crushed 55-gallon barrels, and some household refuse. And I'm going to go through some more of these examples, but what we started noticing is that, you know, the pipe that was discovered with asbestos on it, I mean, they were pretty long lengths. They were 10 foot. The one was 10 feet long, and one was 8 foot long. And there's no mention of pipes in this. No, and I realize that what I'm telling you is it's not what's there, it's what's not on the page. But in Exhibit C, which is a letter from the MPCA to Ron Schmidt, Ron is, the MPCA is very concerned about the sludge and the household yard waste and the crushed barrels. They made a statement in there that we're concerned that you're not restricted to clean demolition fill. So again, it didn't appear back in the 80s that they were all that concerned potentially about concrete and reinforcement, reinforcing bars. The next exhibit that I was going to reference is V. V was an exhibit that we turned in late. And it's not a big deal, but it's an affidavit from Ron Schmidt in 1984, and what Mr. Schmidt is saying is that the materials in the landfill are only road construction materials, primarily soil and concrete. And again, there's no mention of any pipes or anything.
Mr. Chair. Concerning that exhibit, that seems to say that Mr. Schmidt thought that it was only clean material, primarily soil and concrete. And yet the letter from the PCA telling him that they're concerned about these squashed barrels and all this sludge and all this other stuff seems to indicate that Mr. Schmidt wasn't being totally accurate in his description here about what he was accepting. We don't know then exactly what Mr. Schmidt actually was allowing to be dumped on that site.
I'm just trying to bring forth some of the documentation that we looked at, and just that we started noticing that there really was no mention of any pipes until 2004. And I don't want to drag this on too long. The last two exhibits that I would bring forth, that it just seems like there's no mention of pipes, would be Exhibit F and Exhibit G. Exhibit F was a letter from Invergrove Heights to Fratello and Excavating, and I have to read some stuff into this, and so I'm speculating a little bit, but it appeared to me that it was a letter that probably was taking place when they were constructing the road for the Valley View Point development. And they referenced the 30-inch water main and the 18-inch storm sewer, and they talk about being located between lots 2 and 3. And so we know that there was excavation then that was taking place close to the McEachern's home between, you know, we're in that vicinity of lot 2 and 3, and we're excavating out material for storm sewer, so we're probably digging down pretty deep. And they're talking about unsuitable material, and again, this maybe isn't the best, but I'm pointing out what's not there instead of what's listed. They talk about rock, they talk about concrete, unsuitable material within the concrete, but again, if these pipe lengths were 8 and 10 feet, there's no mention of pipe. And we know that they were excavating in 89, and now, of course, MnDOT projects are starting to wind down, and we're probably not demoing a lot, so you know, we're probably not doing a lot of disposal in the area. The last exhibit where the pipe isn't mentioned was Exhibit G. There's no title on this, but Laura went back and looked up who actually we got this document from, and this is a Dakota County investigation form, even though it doesn't say Dakota County. We did double check on it. And again, on the second page of Exhibit G, they talk about item number 7 is, you know, what material was supposed to be there from the files, and it lists a whole bunch of them, you know, concrete, brick, mortar, asphalt, reinforcing rod, wood shingles, the 55-gallon drums come up again, yard waste comes up again, no mention of pipes. And then 8, what was observed in the field, concrete, asphalt, wood waste, and then ongoing dumping of yard and wood waste. The one thing I would point out to you, they did check the box that said the magnetic locator was hitting something, but, you know, so I guess if I was going to justify that to you, I'd say that was probably rebar, but I want to be fair to this document, so, I mean, the magnetic locator did go off, according to that report. That would be the last of the documents that I would present to you that would, you know, that would be the didn't mention pipes. In Exhibit K is the first document that we ran across from Dakota County that talked about asbestos, and here I think maybe is where the mix up on the transite was. I think they called it on the last full paragraph on the first page, it was, in addition, several small pieces of cement tile suspected of asbestos. And I think in the claim, it inadvertently became cement pipe, but I think it was actually siding, so was it tile pipe or tile siding. But here now is where they're starting to test the soils, and they're starting to look at the areas potentially as containing asbestos. So that's kind of the first, you know, affirmative mention of asbestos. And then to me the last area where, you know, we really specifically talk about asbestos is in the claim in September of 2004. And this isn't an exhibit. This was just my copy of the original claim from the McCarran. The second to the last page that I have is, and maybe we already looked at this, it looks like just some handwritten notes. I believe it's a GMD inspection note, dated 9/13. And here's where I believe the pipe coating, approximate 10-foot length on an 8-inch pipe, pipe coating approximate 8-foot length on an 8-inch pipe. And so these are fairly large pieces of pipe that they were testing. And I guess, you know, some of the things I would point out, some are obvious. I mean, this 20 years later, Some other things that I would maybe point out about piling, I would qualify them, however, that I mean, you couldn't be absolutely sure that somebody didn't build a bridge with an 8-inch pile. If you were to talk to our bridge office, and I believe our bridge office would tell you that typically the smallest diameter that we would use is a 12-inch pile with a pipe pile. And then I guess I'm not aware, I'm not saying that it couldn't happen, but I'm not aware of people using hollow piling. Typically we refer to it as cast in place piling. We drive the steel pipes into the ground and then we fill them with concrete. And so if this pipe was hollow, it just would run against, I suppose, probability that it was actually used as piling. Mr. Chair, I think you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. We needed a break anyway, right?
Sure.
You have a tendency to use the word pipe. And I would suggest that others would have a tendency to use the word piling. If you agree that there was either pipe or piling discovered on this site, and if you agree that pipe or that piling was coated with a material that was asbestos or asbestos-like, and if you agree that the pipe and the piling are related to bridge construction and got on the site from a demo of a bridge, could there be any other conclusion that the material came from a MnDOT demolished bridge as opposed to somebody else's bridge, not a MnDOT bridge?
I guess the way I would respond to that is I don't believe that it's probable that those pieces of pipe are piling.
Okay.
So I guess that probably would, just in that one statement, I probably disagree with every if that you threw out.
Okay. Other question?
Oh,
Mr. Chair. Federal one.
I wouldn't be one to tell you how to present your evidence, but it sure seems clear to me that the first thing to do would be to go back and see if there are, in fact, blueprints that show that wood pilings were used or the pilings were steel pilings with steel or concrete encapsulated in them for strength or something like that. And that would really clarify the whole issue, that if that's the way the bridge was built, then it's, we know one way or the other.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but to clarify, we'd really be looking at the bridges that we replaced when we were going through this corridor. It would have been the ones we demolished and took down.
Right, but I mean, if I may follow up, that would clear this issue right then and there. If the plans show that, yes, they used wood pilings, and so how can these pipe pilings be from there? Or no, they used the steel pipe piling, and this is the evidence of it from those bridges. So, I mean, if I were you, I guess that's what I would do, is go back and check those plans. Or if I were your opponent, I would go check those plans also. And
I think it's okay. It's a very good comment, and I appreciate the comments. If a person were going to do that, you probably would want to check maybe most of the bridges that we demolished in that area. I mean, I hate to.
Not just the 110 bridge, you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like it was a little sketchy to get us in the arena. I mean, I don't think we were just playing in the infield here. I think we're playing in the stadium. So I hate to just go in and, you know, take a look at those bridges that were just right at that one interchange based on, you know, the only evidence that we were able to gather.
One last follow-up. Representative Atkins made the point that the plans are kind of in your house. Do they have public access to those plans? What do they need to do to get access to those plans?
In the time that we're at right now with all the data practice requests, I know that, you know, in a lot of instances we have counters or people just come in and observe things. I'm not sure though that I would be comfortable commenting on, you know, the way that we're having to dish out paper right now. I wouldn't be afraid to go, you know, look at them and scrutinize the plans to see if that gives us any more clues in this claim. We're trying to look for the fact. The reason that I say that is that I did not look at the plans, but I had two meetings with our bridge construction folks, and I find them to be very competent people, and so when they told me what they told me, I believed them.
I recognize Ms. Parker here. I recognize Ms. Parker here as basically your PR person for MnDOT, and I guess maybe I would direct that to her, is the access to those plans. You know, it's a public document. I mean, if I wanted to see a school plan, that certainly isn't there's no reason that a school district wouldn't show you somebody the plan. And like I said, to me, this would get to the heart of the matter. Either they use wood pilings, and so then these aren't from your bridge, or they use pipe and very well could be from the bridge.
Mr. Chairman,
I have a question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Mr. Parker from MnDOT. I'm not a PR person, by the way. I'm not in this field. And you are correct that all of the bridge plans are public documents, and we would do our best to produce them if they were requested. And I think that your suggestion that we go back and look at them is an excellent idea, and we will do that.
Okay. Representative Anvil.
Earlier you used the number 7 years. I was picking up that information is redacted after 7 years or something, or eliminated, or whatever. And now you're asking us to go back and do some research to discover, to shed more light on this.
That's a good point. I
am I confused? Probably.
No, you're not confused. When I had referenced the documentation that is destroyed after 7 years, that would have been our contract administration of that particular construction contract documentation. So that would have been the inspector's diaries and a disposal plan if there was one. The other documents that are permanently stored are in the bridge office, and they have just to do with the bridges and some. So you're right. If I gave you the impression that we throw everything away after 7 years, I was incorrect.
President Walker.
Said to Mr. Chair and to Mr. Legard, is there a typical process by which MnDOT would, in contracting for demolition disposal, transfer responsibility for assuring that that's properly handled? Is there a standard contract you've used? It's interesting that the one document references Lunda Building, which you acknowledge is a contractor you've worked with in the past. And I don't hear any kind of reference other than that to them and potential responsibility. And I don't know the law about who is responsible, if it's the generator, you can transfer that to the contractor who assumes some responsibility. Can you give us any clue as to how that typically would have been handled, at least currently, if you're not aware of in the past, back when this would have happened?
Yeah, I guess now currently, of course, it's things like it's a much more regulated process than it used to be, and people really worry about who's the generator, and we sign supplemental agreements in current time with our contractors, and they have language in those supplemental agreements that say even though you're putting it into our trucks, we're never going to be deemed the generator of this waste. And so nowadays it's very well documented. My understanding of contracting back in the 80s was that there were regulations as far as what to do with things like asbestos, but they were not in our contract the way that they are now. I suppose then you would surmise that, you know, more of that would have been on the burden of the contractor. The contractor chooses on our project, and this is the same today as it is or was back then. The contractor chooses where to dispose of things. And that being said, nowadays, except for things like asbestos, you know, we play a very active role in abating asbestos when we're going through and cleaning up areas and such.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, so you would be happy to work with, I mean, if we were not to make a decision today, I'm not suggesting that we make one or not make one, but if we were to not make a decision on this claim today, in order to have an opportunity to look at plans for all of the, we don't know the number, you would cooperate with us and with Representative Atkins in finding how many bridges in that area, how many MnDOT bridges were demolished, and then you would help us find the plan for each of those bridges to see whether they had wooden pilings or pipe pilings or whatever. We could do all that, and you'd be very cooperative and helpful?
I would absolutely be very cooperative and helpful.
Okay. Any other questions?
Sure. Sir, if these were, let's assume for purposes of argument that these were not bridge piles, what else could they be and where could they have come from in your experience?
Well, I think one of the clues you have is right in the claim. I think they're classified as water main.
So if they were water main, that's typically municipally owned or county owned, or could it be state owned?
I'm not,
or privately owned?
You know, this answer maybe isn't necessarily me wearing my MnDOT hat, but I guess I would just say, I mean, typically aren't water departments city? I mean, I suppose you have the Met Council, you know, which, but I don't know if they actually have pipes on. Maybe the safest answer for me putting my MnDOT hat back on is I'm not sure I would know the answer to that question.
Sorry. You'd also mention, number right, correct my number if I'm wrong, that there was not, that MnDOT was not removing asphalt. Did I hear you correctly? I mean, clearly there's some asphalt on their site. Is MnDOT disavowing any connection to the asphalt that was found on the site?
No. I think what I had said or mumbled was, when I read over the asphalt part of it, I said, you know, it probably would be unlikely that Lunda was doing it because they're a bridge contractor, and typically it would be a road contractor that would be extracting asphalt.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess where I'm going with this is, it sounds like if this was either bridge pilings or a water main. And if it were a water main, that would be consistent with the presence of asphalt also found on the Schmidt dump site. It sounds like Schmidt was accepting a whole bunch of stuff from a variety of sources, unregulated, unpermitted. But I think there's another issue there for a different day. But that, however you cut it, the stuff that contained the asbestos, most likely from a publicly owned, product. I mean, you typically wouldn't see a water main installed as part of a private development. And then, so it, maybe the question is, was this a municipally owned piping, or whatever you can call it, or was it somehow connected to MnDOT and its excavation? I don't know if we'll be able to answer the question. We might be able to answer part of that question when we find out what the bridge that was demolished, the bridges in that area that were demolished, contained.
Then we get two other questions then. One is it the state's responsibility, or would it be a local government's responsibility for having inappropriately excavated and dumped stuff on this site? And then the last question, if we can narrow it down at least to a government responsibility, what's the role of the state? The claims committee being sort of sitting at the judges, I guess, because there's no viable judicial alternative, it sounds like, to resolving this dispute. What's the state's responsibility, or what should it be? Is this a situation where the state should step in and should create some sort of a remedy here, where there might not be another remedy, whether it's MnDOT's responsibility or local government's responsibility, or how do we sort that out? We're in kind of a unique situation here. We've got seven-year retention records, which are quite common among government agencies, that have gotten us to a point that there's a certain lack of documentation that's available. There's some documentation we haven't explored yet, which I think we should explore. We're beyond statute of limitations as a practical matter, so the judicial process is not, it sounds like it's not a viable alternative, which is one reason people tend to come to claims. And one reason we tend to deny claims, historically, is that if you've got a remedy in court, go there first. As a general rule, that's been our approach to claims. But if that's not an alternative, does the state have some role that we should play in doing the just or equitable thing here? And I think we need to answer some questions before we make that decision, which is why I would support where Mr. Lindeke at least was intimating as an option, is let's get a little more information before we make a decision on this. But even beyond that, we might have some broader questions to ask. If there isn't a fund, I can't imagine this is the first time this question has ever come up, where 30 years after stuff is dumped on a site, there are questions about where it came from and who's responsible, and you've got an innocent property owner that's left holding the bag. And if there isn't a source of money that's available to deal with those kind of situations in Minnesota right now, and Superfund name for some reason doesn't cover it from a federal standpoint, Minnesota Superfund, I think we've got some Minnesota funds. I'm not involved in that area directly, but maybe there ought to be. And maybe we ought to be looking at turning to those funds as opposed to necessarily a claim committee resolution which generally comes out of the general fund. I'm raising these questions. I'm not sure what the answers are at this point, but I think we need some more information on those kind of options.
So, Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, I've got two questions that I just want to ask while we still have people here who can possibly answer them. One, you said that they could be water mains. And the indications that we have in the photos and in some of the other discussion is that these things bend. They don't fracture apart the way a water main would fracture if you tried to bend it. That these appear to be pipes and not water mains. Have you looked at the pictures? Is that right? You think they're water mains?
Well, I believe an 8-inch diameter steel pipe could. Yeah, I mean it's feasible that it could be a water main.
Right. And then the other question that I have, Mr. Chair, it's probably for either Representative Atkins or the McEachran, and that is these pictures show these pipes, whatever they are, lying out just covered with overgrowth. And so how long had they been sitting there when these pictures were taken? They're not still there, are they?
No. They were there a couple of years.
I see. So after they were, the answer was they've been there a couple of years. After they were dug up, excavated, they sat around for a while.
They were excavated.
Mr. McEachran, could you come up to the table, please?
They were excavated in the spring of 2004, and the cleanup occurred in August of 2006.
Okay.
The reason the weeds are there is because we weren't supposed to.
I'm not criticizing you, Mr. McEachran, for the weeds. I was just wondering why they looked like they've been there forever. And it's because they have been there for a while. All right.
McEachran, that's all we have up there. Were the pipes or the pilings filled with anything?
There seemed to be something inside. They were too heavy for me to push or move around. I do know I'm pretty good at estimating, you know, inches, and I don't know if they actually mean any, you know, where they're said to be 8-inch pipe and they're said to be 10 feet long and 8 feet long. In my looking at them, I would say they were longer than that and more than 8 inches. Because 8 inches is about that, and these pipes were bigger. They were more like that. But yeah, you're going off that map. But, you know, if we would have known, we would have taken better pictures than that.
Hands off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We probably need some expert information from a contractor, but it strikes me as odd that a pipe that would transmit water, municipal water, would be coated with a material that contained asbestos. Even in the 50s, that would strike me as odd. I suppose it's possible, but for now, I'd like an answer to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might refer you to our report, the letter from Mr. Habinger does discuss those issues in paragraph 3, the last page of the red folder. Paragraph 3, he discusses the ductile iron used for water mains, as you know, it's brittle, cannot be bent or deformed, the equal bent and deformed. Acid coatings were only applied to steel or iron that was buried underground, and it continues. And then the other thing he presents is the fifth paragraph.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we're continuing to explore further questions and speculate, and I was up to do with the cleanup, but it does seem to me, I mean, this last letter as under the violet cap does reference that it could potentially be a gas pipe. You think of radiator pipes in a big industrial situation might have been buried underground between buildings, and you know, there could be potentially some other things, but in terms of the actual size of it and whether or not it was hollow or that, I would wonder whether or not the excavating company that did the cleanup work under the supervision of Dakota County, typically in getting a bid and, you know, describing their stuff as delivering it to an appropriate, you know, appropriately sealed hazardous waste landfill. I suspect there's some documentation on that would be also available to clarify the nature of what was hauled away, and that might be information that could be obtained through Dakota County with whoever they hired to do the contracting to clarify this question of what was the size and the life, and, you know, was it hollow or wasn't it, those sorts of things.
Other questions? Mr.
Sure, one last question. In reading this stuff, it talks about the Dakota County spreading the cost, the remaining $67,000 apparently on your property as an expense. What's the urgency on this? When are you going to actually have to start paying any of the $67,000? January of 2008.
All of it in 2008, or?
No, it's a 30-year 4%.
Okay.
And the interest is more than 57.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Okay, I would, members, I just want to discuss this a little bit further. Stay right there for a while. I have been involved with this as a legislator. I do not know the McEachran on a personal basis whatever, but I read about this in the newspaper when it was first occurring, and I was very disturbed that we would have old waste, demolition waste, that would be uncovered in normal activities that people are, and then there's somehow there's no way to take care of it. And I know that back in the 90s when we were dealing this with mixed municipal landfills, and we had everyone suing everyone because there was contamination, and the state would go after the big dogs, and the big dogs would turn around and file lawsuits against every common pop shop in the state trying to recover their costs. But the state stepped in and said, wait a minute, we'll set up a special fund on how to deal with these. And I really think that that's where this needs to eventually go. That doesn't take care of the situation that's in front of us right now, but I think that the I didn't say anything deliberately earlier in the meeting because I didn't want to mislead anybody, but I have or to lead you anywhere in any direction, but from now that we're testimony in, so to speak, I want to let you know that I really think this is a huge issue. It could have happened to any of us. They excavated the material. Correct me, Mr. McEachran, if I get anything wrong. But as they dug the hole for their basement, the material is now on the surface. That created the problem. And so people were upset in the county and others. At least that's the impression I got, that you continued with your construction when, in fact, didn't make any difference. Once the material was on top of the surface, the problem was there. And so it has just been extremely difficult to try and deal with these things. I saw these pipes. I wish I had taken a picture or I had gone over and actually looked inside, but it was my recollection that they were contained, that they were filled with material. I did not perceive that they were pipes. And I just looked at them, and it just as they were, I don't know if there was something in the end or whatever, it kind of made me indicate or feel that they were filled with stuff. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get some additional information on some of this. Because the PennDOT didn't try to create this problem. This is just created. It was clean. Back in those days, this was known as clean fill. And nobody knew any different. And yet, as this gets deposited in a ravine, and the ravine 20 years later gets opened up for development, all of a sudden this stuff gets put on the surface. Now we test for something we weren't testing for at the time of demolition or the time of disposal. And according to county law, it's my understanding, the burden falls back onto the property owner. Now it's also my understanding, and I haven't looked into it carefully, but the generally within the state of Minnesota, pollution is actually looked at those who deposit the pollution or cause the pollution underneath state law. So there is seems to be a difference in how we handle some of this around the state. I think that also needs to be looked at and to make sure that we're dealing with this evenly. Mr. Schmidt, has he been asked about where these pilings came from? If he knew that there, and if I didn't see this letter before with regard to Lunda construction, but he evidently said that Lunda was depositing material there. Anybody asked him if he knows where the material is coming from? Mr. Spong, that still works for the county, I believe. Last time I dealt with him, he had a mine like a steel trap, so he probably already knows where this stuff came from if we get a hold of him. And I do think we should get information from the county to see what their records have identified as what was disposed of. Because the biggest difference that occurred here was not just that the material was exposed, because the McEachrans would have to dispose of that anyway. You know, once you bring up this big chunk of concrete, you're going to have to do something with it. You're not going to hide it in the back 40, so you have to do something with it. It's going to go for a disposal site. But once it was identified as containing asbestos, the cost went out of sight. Now everything had to be handled as hazardous waste, whether that's justified or not. From a common sense standpoint, that's the way it was dealt with from a legal standpoint and from a pollution control standpoint. So it's a lot of disturbing questions, and I don't think that we're ready to deal with those today. I would encourage us to ask whatever other questions we may have of these people at this moment, and then if we would set this aside and see if we can't get a hold of Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Spong, and Dakota County, and anyone else that you'd like to put on the list. You know, that sounds like a sense of direction. Okay. We have Representative Atkins. I believe you have something else you want to say, and then we'll see if there are any other questions.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Members, one minor point in that is just a date or a deadline would be helpful, I think, with respect to the. And I don't want this to sound like a slam on our friends at MnDOT, but the claim was filed in February. It was 4 days ago that we received, I think the response was dated October 30th. Had we been aware that they were going to claim that they only had wood creosote as Senator Osteen, we would have chased that information down ourselves. I don't want this to go out another 7 months, so if you could at least give us a deadline in terms of when those will be produced to the committee. And we didn't actually get, I didn't get their response. I don't know if McEachern's ever got their response. But that we be on their list to produce that information to. And I'd suggest to you that perhaps by a month from now, certainly a month is a lot of time in which to find those drawings. And then we'll take a look at those drawings. My only other point with respect to that is I think the smoking gun here, regardless of whether or not, and you look at Mr. Havage's letter that basically rules out the other possibilities. But the fact is that whatever they are and whatever they're filled with, they're within the direct proximity. They're right, you know, this is a very small site that we're talking about. They're right part of the bridge demolition work. So whatever they were part of that bridge, which means the owner was MnDOT, which, and I'm not expecting to take action today, but it seems very clear that whatever was there was all part of one dump. That was dumped from that demolished bridge. I think it bears, you know, I think we'd all be remiss if we didn't take a look at those drawings. But as long as we've got a deadline and a time frame in which to work, we're not waiting 7 more months to find something here.
And Mr. Ligard, I think I really appreciate your comment about that let's look at the whole area and not just one site, because there are several bridges, Concord and Highway 100, another, there's even some railroad bridges that got taken out, I believe, in the reconstruction of 494 in Highway instead of Highway 100 like it used to be. You know. So there's lots of changes that took place right about this period of time. So a lot of things that need to be looked at in that quarter. To give us some clues, it won't give us any absolutes, because you don't, unless we can come up with some recollection of, yes, that material came from that bridge. I don't know if we'll even find that.
Mr. Chair, just in reference to the time it's taken to get the Department of Transportation's response, it did seem to take a long time. There were notes in March and April that we'd get back to you in 30 days, and then we'd get our response in 2 weeks, and of course it took until October. So. But I think what I heard was that there's going to be enthusiastic cooperation in trying to resolve all of this from the Department of Transportation.
I don't want to underestimate. This is an incredibly difficult situation to try and get our arms around. I mean, we had several meetings and did data requests from the county and the city. So I mean, we put a lot of time and effort into trying to present the fairest, you know, facts that we could. And so if you're unhappy with the, you know, the timeline, I guess I, you know, apologize, but it's just a very complex situation.
Mr. Chair, I'm not unhappy. There was a lot of stuff. It's just, it was hard to read all that stuff in just a few days before this meeting.
And sure. I think we all understand that, you know, the department's been kind of going through hell here lately. So it's a lot of things have occurred, and that none of us are trying to pile on. But we really do appreciate your willingness to open things up. Let's see if we can do it as fast as possible. We have a deadline in the fact that the session's coming up. And if we're going to take some action, we need to put it in the form of a bill and have it go through the legislature, unless the department comes to some agreement that doesn't require that. Other questions? Representative Atkins, do you have something else?
The question of Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Spong, Mr.
Chair, you indicated they'd be contacted. You want, we're happy to do so.
That'd be great.
If you were directing somebody else, we're going to overwhelm Mr. Spahn and Mr. Schmidt.
And if you could communicate with Mr. Lindeke on that, it'd be great. We really appreciate it because we don't have any staff.
No, we will. I just wanted to make sure we weren't sending, you know, six people and my friend Mr. Liegard and a whole bunch of people to go talk to the same people. We'd be happy to, and we'll approve whatever they have to say for it.
All right. Representative Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as long as we're making lists of things to follow up on, and since there has been testimony that the PCA has been consulted and involved in this, I would really appreciate some clarification on why the state super fund law is not able to step into these situations, because I thought that was the intent of creating a state fund to pick up where the fed for projects that weren't large enough for the federal. And so, you know, I think that it would be useful for us to know what gaps there are, because that is the process I thought that was to remedy these situations.
Well, yes, I think there's actually a letter, somebody, a memo on it, so we'll apply the committee with that.
And it has the Superfund has some specific guidelines that are by their end. So the legislature has kind of narrowed that down in some cases. So we may need to disclose that, enlarge that, but if we do, you may have to find a funding source in order to do it. So that becomes the real stickler, like everything else, a little money. Anything else? I really appreciate the patience of everyone. I empathize with your situation. I know that if it happened to be my property, they'd have done the same thing. But I don't move. I've lived in the same house all my life, so I haven't done anything there. I don't have the problem. But if you buy a piece of property, it's buyer beware the way it is right now. So just you turn it up, and even if it looks like it's supposed to be clean still, and it identifies as something wrong, you would get stuck with cleaning up regardless of who put it there. Evidently, that's the way things are currently. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. See, we have, I have lost my agenda. Who do we have next?
Baker.
Baker?
Yes. Bernard and Nancy.
Baker? It's got to be
against the Department of Health. Who is here? Who are here?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Bernard Baker.
Summarize it.
That'd be great.
Baker bought a piece of property at 2040
Tillman.
Yeah, it's Tillman. And it was part of a piece of property that was 2034 Cleveland Avenue North.
Right.
That was divided. The Bakers built on the 2040 piece of land. It turned out that there had been a well on the 2034 property.
Right.
And the Department of Health became aware that there had been an untapped well, and they determined through what turned out to be a mistaken reasoning that the well must be on the 2040 piece of part of the land. And it turned out that the well was right near the house at 2034 when they actually found it. But in digging for the well, which was very expensive for the Bakers, they actually found buried fuel tanks, oil tanks. Is that right? And so part of the, if there had been nothing when they dug, it probably would be a very easy question. But the problem is that when they did dig for the well that wasn't there, they found the foundation of a greenhouse and some oil tanks, which had to then be removed. And their claim is for the cost of all of this excavation and for restoring the property once it was done.
Well, there's information to add to that.
There's a few statements there that isn't quite the way it was. First, we purchased the house. The house was already on the property when we purchased it. We've been there for 33 years. And the well in question was drilled in 1927, and they followed a copper tubing from the house at 2034 onto our property. And I think anybody that is old enough to remember, back in 1927, they didn't have copper tubing for water lines. And if they had put in the proper lines, it would be either lead pipe or galvanized pipe. But they found this copper tubing, and I explained to them at the time that when you find a pipe, you don't know if which way the water is moving. If it's moving from the house to the old greenhouse site or from the greenhouse to the old house site. But I had discussed the property with the person that was the resident at 2034 Cleveland, and he gave me the background of our property, that they had bulldozed the site and leveled it off for development, and in doing so, they covered up parts of the greenhouse. And I made this aware to the personnel from the health department that this is a site that you're probably reading buried tanks or something like that from the greenhouse, or even part of the boiler. And but for the fact that they insisted, in fact, well, they forced us into digging for the abandoned well they were looking for, because they stated if I didn't dig for the well, they would make it impossible for me to ever sell my property until I did. And because of health problems, I could not have that hanging over my property. So in 2004, they started looking for the well. In 2005, they said they found it, the pipe leading my way. We had measured the length of the pipe, and it ended up on my property. So where the well reading was, he claimed, from his meter, it was right by one of my big birch trees. So I had a new driveway put in my property when the city resurfaced the street. And it was a finance driveway, and it was quite an expensive expenditure. And I have pictures that I could show you the width of the area that we're talking about. It's a 12-foot strip between my driveway and my property line. And I told them I will not have a backhoe up working on my driveway and using my expensive driveway. So I took the trees down because they were too close together to get a backhoe in to dig in the area where the well was supposed to be, because there's only like 24 feet between the two birch trees. And I measured out a backhoe, and a backhoe fully retracted in a traveling position takes an area of 26 feet just to get the backhoe in there, because I had to work on the 10-foot strip to have the backhoe set parallel to the strip. And in having the backhoe that way, it meant that I had to eliminate my two big birch clumps so that the backhoe could work there. Because along the property line, there was a 6-foot basket weave fence that divided the two properties. So in the fall of 2005, I took down the two birch trees to make ready for the excavation. And I called the person in charge at the Department of Health, and he said that if I dug for the well, or I said to him, if I dig for the well, is this the end of it? He said, no. He said, you've got to keep digging until you find that well. And I said, well, I'm not going to dig them until you show me just exactly where that well is. Well, they finally come up with the spot that's stated in the literature. And when I got the well man out there, the state was the one who was directing them where to dig. And I ended up with an excavation that was 16 feet wide along my property line, and it was 8 feet coming right up against my cement driveway, and that was the room that we found underneath the old greenhouse. And we could look down in because part of the wall of the old basement was caved in, and we could see there was something under there. So then we decided that we had to break up the steel reinforced cement ceiling or floor, whichever you wanted to call it, from the basement compartment underneath it. So we knocked a hole in it, and then we could see the tanks in there. Well, then after getting in there and checking everything, they decided that the valve couldn't be in there, so then they did some checking and found the old owner of the place that lived at 2034, and he told them, no, the well isn't over there, it's back over at 2034. So then they walked away to the health department after telling me that there'd be money coming if I would probably go to the Department of Commerce. They would have money to remove these two tanks. Well, I called them, and he said, well, there's money, but we don't have any now. And this was in April. And I had the option of filling the excavation in or leaving it. But if you have an excavation that's 16 feet wide and 8 feet in a sort of a pie-shaped size, and it's about 12 feet deep, and the neighbors, it was acting like it was a circus there, and if somebody would have fallen in the hole and gotten hurt, I assume the state would take responsibility for it. And so I had an option of, like they told me from the Commerce Department, I could fill it back in temporarily, and they would come back out and dig it out and take the tanks out if there was money. And so I contacted Dean's Tank Service and had them come out and look at the situation and ask him what it would he would charge me for taking the tanks out. And he said, well, and he said, it'll be $1,000 for your permit and taking the tanks out. And I said, well, what would it cost if I fill it back in and you come out and take it out under the state plan? He said, probably about $3,500. So I checked to see what it would cost me to fill the hole back in, and it would cost me as much to fill the hole in as it would to take the tank out, and the tank company was going to partially fill the hole back in if they took the tank out. So if I hauled in two loads of dirt and hired a man to come out with a skid loader to fill it in and put it back in some semblance of what it was, I'd be spending more than it would cost me to take the tanks out. Well, I worked for the state for 20 years, so I knew how the state worked, and they say they're going to do something, but sometimes they don't get it done very fast. So I took the position that I said to the state, I said, I will take the tanks out, and if you get funds, you can reimburse me later. They said, we don't operate that way. Well, they were trying to operate that way out in the cross town where they wanted the contractor to do the work and they would pay them later, so I figured there's no difference. But I decided that I might as well take the tanks out and take the chance that I would get reimbursed for it, because they would be spending no more money for me taking the tanks out, in fact probably less than if I filled the hole back in and then the state come out and spent probably $3,000 to $4,000 to excavate them and take the tanks out at a later date. So that's what I did. And to me, it was nothing but simple economics to save the state $3,500 of their charge against what I paid to get the tanks out, which was no more than what it would cost to fill the hole back in and leave them there until somebody else did it.
Okay. We have questions. Okay. Thank you very much. I think we'll have, who do we have here from the departments. Anybody? Would you like to come to the table and
did the baker sign the witness sheet?
I know he did.
Oh, you can do it later. Thank you. Just a reminder. But you two gentlemen will, I'm sure.
Of course. Mr. Chair, John Stein with the Health Department, Environmental Health Division Director, and Mr. Wilson, Dan Wilson, our well management program. Mm-hmm. Basically, we did provide you a letter trying to summarize all the details, which we don't dispute the details. The question, I think, was one of, did we follow our, did we always do what we always do on these matters? And we did what we always do. Whenever we get a question regarding locating an abandoned well, we look on the property for evidence because frequently there aren't records of old wells and there aren't detailed property records. So our inspection staff went out and looked the best of their ability to locate all the likely locations on property where abandoned well might have been. And that's the process that we followed. So we, using the magnetometer and other inspection methods, looked around. And I would say that what Mr. Baker described is accurate in terms of how the sequence of events occurred. And he also did comply with the request of our staff to do the best inspection and follow-up in locating any abandoned wells on the property. As he noted, was that we didn't, in fact, find an abandoned well. We found a buried tank, and that led to the complications that that now have been described. I'm going to let Mr. Wilson describe any more details that he wants to fill in.
Mr. Wendeke.
Well, in reading the letter from Mr. Wilson, which was dated in July, very prompt response, by the way, Mr. Wilson. I kept looking at the end for any words that said we recommend denial of the claim, but it doesn't say that. Instead, it outlines what happened. It indicates that there was not necessarily any negligence on your part or any mistake, except that the mistake was that the well wasn't on their property. And later on, you found out why, and you found out where the well was. And then you dealt with the well where it was. So there was a mistake in fact, but no negligence probably on the part of the department. And the part of your letter that deals with the claim itself merely talks about the amounts of the claim. And so possibly you don't agree that that all of it is caused by the Department of Health, is caused by the Department of Health mistake as to where the well was. Does that pretty well summarize the position of the department?
Chair, Mr. Lindeke, yes, that is correct. Apportioning the amount of the claim is the challenge that I would we did not make a statement of what we felt the appropriate amount of allocation of any costs might be. I do note that while Mr. Baker consulted with the Department of Commerce about their petroleum fund, I don't know that they actually applied or pursued that remedy to its full extent.
Yes, Mr. Eideke?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Baker explained why that was, and it probably saved somebody, some other agency, to take some cost in the long run by doing what it is he did. That's the impression I can.
Well, I'm not going to speak as though I understand the Department of Corrections decision-making process. However, I do know, that until you apply, you never know what the answer is going to be.
I think he said that there was, when he did contact him, they said there wasn't any money available, and that is probably accurate. Depending upon the budgeting process, we were in some pretty tight times, and if the money wasn't coming in, the money wasn't available at that point. it's the petrol fund that we're talking about. And but I think that it would benefit the committee if we could get you to maybe work with the bakers to find out what is a an appropriate figure. And let's talk to the Department of Commerce and see if we can't get them to loosen up some of that petrol fund money to cover it. After all, through all this aggravation, we did find two abandoned tanks. And we're all better for it, because someday that they were going to be released. So it, or it's going to cause somebody else problems down the road with regard to transfer of properties or whatever. We're trying to get rid of those abandoned tanks. So I think if we could get some collaboration going there, maybe they would be willing to open up the petrol fund to maybe even reimburse the Department of Health for helping discover this whole thing, and you can get around some of the red tape difficulty, or maybe we can do it legislatively. But I think that you know, you were pursuing something that was absolutely what you need to pursue, and it was the wrong property that actually ended up with the problem, and yet we have discovered a problem that did get created, but we have a fund that normally can help people in that situation. So see if we can't work something out. That would be my suggestion.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the reasons we felt it was important to come here and hear from you what you felt an appropriate response would be. We're very happy to work with Department of Commerce and with the bakers to sit down and see what we can arrive at, knowing that you're interested in seeing that kind of solution.
Does that sound okay to us members? Representative Loeffler, and I think Mr. Baker wants to say something else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with that approach, but I have to say I also think it's good when citizens step up and prevent a bigger liability. And I would have hoped, you know, I think the situation of having potentially children falling into an open, dangerous area while someone's waiting for another state agency to get its pot of gold refilled. It seems like it was a logical decision. It wasn't a, you know, one that's going to do this and send the bill to the state. It was a really thoughtful sort of approach, and I think we had to honor and respect that action on the part of the basin.
And I know, Chair, that you will work at it. Yes. You're pretty successful coming up with good solutions. Well, Mr. Baker, would you like to continue to come up again and address the committee? We won't have an answer for you today, but as you heard, we're going to kind of encourage that people get working together and help you get this resolved.
Well, I just would like to state when they're talking about pause, that there's additional costs that I never put in for, because I had a retaining wall along my property that I had to tear out because of the digging. And when I tore out the wall, the old landscaping timbers were starting to rot, so it ruined the landscaping timbers. So I took the whole wall out, the full length of the property, and I made an agreement with the neighbor, instead of putting the retaining wall back in there, that if he was agreeable, I would haul dirt in and landscape his yard to meet mine. And also, at this time, I notice now, because of the digging, my driveway is starting to sink. And I'm going to have to do some grinding to try to get the cement level again from this. So I'm not making a thing. I'm just trying to get back what I've had put out.
Or some mud pumping to get this concrete back up. The, those types of things are things you can discuss between the agencies. And you need to keep in mind also that it was it's illegal to have abandoned tanks. So there is an obligation on your part to remove the tanks once they were discovered. But we have a fund to try and help with that, but it may not cover all costs. But we'll see what the negotiations can work out.
Well, as I say, I had no problem with taking the tanks out, because I figured I was saving the state more money than what it was costing me to do it. Because if they didn't take it out, I'd have to go back and pay for filling it, and then I'd have to go back and pay for taking the tanks out, so I was looking at the expenditure of $1,000 against possibly $3,500 or more additionally that I've had to pay.
We understand that, Mr. Baker. We have a really tight schedule, so we're going to have to move on.
Okay, thank
but if but they will they have committed to working with you on this and see if we can't come up with a resolution.
Mr. Baker, why don't you write your name and your wife's name on that, and that'll take care of that.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a quick question. Is it not the protocol that if there's some questions about whether and where the well is located on the new property to contact previous property owners to ask them questions? I mean, a couple of phone calls could have saved thousands of dollars worth of staff time and all the headache that we have here. I don't understand why that wasn't done.
The last thing, Mr. Linkstein will answer that. To the table, please. Thank you, Mr. Baker. We appreciate it.
Chair, Senator Latz, my understanding is we did make attempts to connect with previous property owners, and we do that as a course of normal course of business. We weren't successful. Somehow, later down the line, it was successful. So perhaps we weren't diligent enough. It's a point well taken. You know, you don't want to exhaust your resources going probing around people's property when you just got to pick up the phone. That's common sense, and we're smart enough to try to do that. Sometimes I would say it doesn't always happen easily, and so we, in the interest of getting things resolved, we then take the next step, which is to go start inspecting and looking at equipment.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, the next one is Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Lehman?
And Mr. Lehman.
And would you give us a little...
Mr. Chair, you recall meeting the Lehmans back in the spring. As we were dealing with their claim, Mr. Lehman, as you know, is not has not had his license renewed to be a well driller. And I just noticed as I was going through some earlier material that in 1996, Mr. Lehman filed a claim, and I can kind of recall that, in fact, you were here for that too, Representative Osmond, in which Mr. Lehman filed a claim for the loss of his well drilling business, which he said he had to sell because the Department of Health refused to renew his drilling license. Mr. Lehman explained his claim for $100,000. Mrs. Lehman introduced herself and gave her support to Mr. Lehman's claim. The members of the subcommittee asked the Lehman's question. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Harris of the Department of Health presented the department's response and said the claim shouldn't be paid. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Harris explained Mr. Lehman's license had not been renewed at that time, because he had failed to give the department the results of lab tests conducted on water samples taken from numerous wells that he had drilled. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Harris said the department's rules require those lab tests. The subcommittee members discussed the claim. They denied the claim. So that was back in 96. Presumably after that time, you must have started submitting whatever these results were. And so that your license was then renewed after 1996 at some point. And then you came to us this past year saying that your license had not been renewed again because you felt that they were requiring you to identify that you were a user of explosives. And I believe at the time they responded that that wasn't a requirement, that you needn't do that. And so now... I was kind of generous over the summer, Mr. Chair, when people said, can I file a new claim because your claim had already been denied on the basis of new information. Well, I guess I was pretty generous about saying that you had new information for us. So now we have the claim again, and it's basically the same claim with a few other pieces of information, including the fact that now you've talked apparently to Representative Seifert. You've had Representative Holberg draft a bill concerning storage locations of explosives,
But other than that, there's very little new information. Is that what I understand?
Trying to.
Fred Lehman. And in 2004, the federal government and the Homeland Security took over the lighting and on explosives.
We remember that testimony.
Before 2004, we just got a permit from the sheriff.
Uh-huh.
And we did not have to document anything.
What is the new information, Mr. Landis? But your claim based upon what the discussions you're starting to have has already been denied. What new information do you have?
Here's the booklet that you buy across the counter on explosives. It tells you how to blow bridges, railroads, everything in there. And I store explosives. And it's out on the internet that I use explosives in the wells. It's their code state that we use it.
We've heard this testimony before, Mr. Lehman. What's the new information that you have?
The President Bush signed the Power Act, which states that the state, in their code, must have safeguards to protect the users of explosives.
Mr. Lehman, we're trying to give you an opportunity to give us new information, and you're going over the same material that you've already presented to this committee.
Yes.
Mr. Lehman, did you get a copy of this most recent letter, the one dated September 13th, from the Department of Health concerning the requirement that you, the lack of a requirement that you report your use of explosives? Did you get a copy of this?
We did not get that letter.
Dan, could you give this to Mr. Lehman? And that letter says what we thought we understood back in the spring, and that is that you're not required on your well record form to report the use of explosives. This is another letter on September 13th of this year indicating once again that you're not required to indicate to use explosives.
That is wrong. Rock is a part of the geological condition. We use dynamite to bust rock. And we have to put it in the well now. The hardness, if it's a rock formation or whatever it is. And right in the code, it states that we use explosives. And the ATF, we have to document every place that we use explosives. And when it's done in a well, that's got to be documented. That's by the ATF.
Okay. Any new information, Mr. Lane?
And I got the proposed bill in legislation now to make the storage of explosives non-public information.
And that'll be introduced, provided you find an author, that'll be introduced in February, and it'll be come up in the next legislative session. We're not involved with that on this committee.
But I've done that to put safeguards on for the other contractors.
Okay.
Because every contractor that uses it is in the same situation.
Okay. Any questions?
May I speak?
Yes, ma'am. Sure can.
Number one, it seems this committee at the very beginning all the lies the health department has stated. The health department does not care about a person's health or welfare. And Mr. Lurie, I want to ask you directly. The first time we were at this committee, you said you wanted in writing some information why it's dangerous to have this information on the internet. We came back the second time with the letter from Homeland Security, from Ryan. We came back with a letter with our county sheriff, and he said it wasn't good enough. But I want to know why. These people are in charge of the health and welfare,
and protection of the people in our area and of the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Bowman, we've already heard this testimony.
You didn't hear from me that way.
What is new?
The new thing is, if some of our explosives are stolen, and somebody goes out there and blows something up, those explosives are going to use for kill and terrorize. The state is not going to take responsibility. They're going to go to whoever holds that permit and say, it's in your name, not ours. You don't claim any responsibility whatsoever. And pray to God, you as a committee and legislators will have to answer to the people feeding when this happens, because you were warned this is going to happen. And evidently you don't care and you don't have enough backbone to stand up to them either.
Okay. We heard that. Any questions?
The other thing I want to say.
Well, Mr. Lamo, we have a really tight agenda.
I know, but this
we've
is
given you an opportunity to present new information.
Well logged, put out by other dealers.
Okay.
It's so far out of line that you cannot use them for reference. If you look at them, look, they use 2-inch screens and 4-inch welds.
That's not part of your claim, Mr.
Okay, I'll find another one.
Okay. Any other comments?
I would just like to say that.
I make a motion that we deny the claim.
Okay.
Any questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Thanks for bill. Claim is denied.
You're going to have a lot of blood on your hands when this happens. You were warned.
Mr. Chair. Could I ask if we could revert to the Okino claim and deal with it at this point?
Sure. Remember, we have Mr. Kino was here earlier. And do you have any comments? Anyone, first of all, would like to make that motion? I suggest to your staff. What the members do?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we revert to the Okino claim.
Okay. Brings a new claim. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevailed. Okay, we're now on the Okino claim. What would we like to do with the Okino?
I would make a motion to deny.
Okay. Motion is made to deny the Okino claim. Any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The Okino claim is denied. Mr. Lendeke, what do we have next?
Mr. Chair, I think the next claims are against the department, the good old trusty Department of Corrections.
Right.
And the first two...
can I ask a question?
Yes. Senator Olson.
Marie had a separate claim.
Ah, yes.
And we didn't take any action.
Oh, she has a separate one?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Correct. We chase them down the hall, or what do we do?
No.
I would mean to deny it.
Yeah.
If
that would be fine.
Okay. I would make a motion that we would deny the Marie Lehman claim.
Okay, a motion is made to deny the Lee Lehman claim. Any questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, that was a very good catch by Senator Olson.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. All right. I'm only getting so bored.
He was a pretty good fellow.
The
Mr. Chair, the let's take up David Dawson first. I don't think that would take a very long time.
Okay.
We're not going to hear the claim. We're only going to discuss that we're not going to hear it.
Okay.
Don't worry, Mr. Hartman. Mr. Chair, the Dawson claim, as you recall, back in the spring, we met with Mr. Engelbrechtson, who was a lawyer from Duluth, an aging lawyer who had trouble getting down there, and he had been representing Mr. Dawson for some number of years before the claim subcommittee. And we allowed Mr. Dawson to testify further concerning the Dawson claim. Mr. Dawson wasn't there. I believe he was already incarcerated. And Mr. Engelbrechtson succeeded in getting Mr. Dawson a claim recommendation for $3,750. Mr. Dawson was offered that amount of money, and his response to Mr. Hartnett and then directly to the subcommittee was, I'm not taking $3,750. I've fired my lawyer, Mr. Engelbretson, and I will settle with you for some larger amount of money. I'm not even sure exactly. $12,500 down to $9,500. He will settle with us for a larger amount of money and doesn't choose to take the $3,750. So I thought that the subcommittee ought to at least hear about what's going on with the Dawson claim. I don't think any action is necessary, except that unless someone wants to reopen the Dawson claim and negotiate with Mr. Dawson concerning his injury.
I have a question, Mr. Wendeke. When a settlement like this is offered and it's denied,
this was paid.
But he didn't. He refused the
amount, Mr. Chair.
He refused the check.
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmer, Mr. Dawson was an inmate at one of our correctional facilities. Although, as you recall, this claim arose out of the Ramsey County Jail.
Did he accept it?
We asked both he and his attorney to give us instructions as to how they wanted the check to be sent, either to the attorney's office or to Mr. Dawson at his inmate account. And the response that we got, we didn't get any response from the attorney, but we got the response that Mr. Wendeke just talked about. So understand that no checks are actually sent. This is electronic transfer generally. But the funds are still in the budget at the Department of Corrections.
Yeah, and I guess that's the heart of my question then is what happens to the $3,750?
Mr. Chair, that money would return to the general fund at the end of the fiscal year when the appropriation expires.
It will automatically do that?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. And we do not have to take any action. Anyone want to take any action with regard to Dawson file? Okay, the Dawson file be set aside.
Chair? So we don't need to reaffirm that we've denied it or anything?
Nothing. It'll just disappear.
Lay on the table.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification. Mr. Dawson's claim was awarded, and the funds are there, and I'm trying to determine whether it's the subcommittee's wish that we let him know that there will be no further money forthcoming, or that we let him know that the funds that we currently have are no longer available to him.
Mr. Chair, I would think that the proper response would be to say that the money is still available. We authorized $3,750. You're welcome to it if you accept it.
And it's only available
at
the end of the fiscal year. If he doesn't make a decision, it's gone.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Wendeke, as you're aware, Mr. Dawson would be required to sign a release before the funds would be submitted to them.
Okay. Very good. Right. Any other questions on that? All right. The Dawson will be set aside. Mr. Wendeke, where do we go to my
question? Mr. Chair, as I pointed out in discussing Mr. Lehman's claim, I was very generous this year in authorizing the refiling of claims by people, and one of the others was a claim by Mr. Butters. And as you recall, Mr. Butters cut off part of his finger.
You watched the video, correct?
And the video showed us nothing. But he did cut off part of his finger. I hope you didn't bring the video back again, did you, Mr. Harkin?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wendeke, I did not, but I will explain that to you in just a moment.
All right. In any event, Mr. Butters then wrote us all kinds of letters asking us to reconsider his claim, not reconsider it, but to he opened a new claim and spent $5 to reopen the claim. And I hope that you've all read a lot of these letters from Mr. Butters. There's a lot of it. I think there is new evidence in them. Mr. Butters explains, for example, that he, as far back as 2004, people were saying, don't let this man be near any shark. And then, of course, he is at some point assigned to work in the kitchen. And on his first day, he manages to cut his finger. There is evidence that people knew he had a mental problem and that yes, they let him work in the kitchen without any particular instruction as to how to use the knife. it just strikes me that there's a, I realize that the Department of Corrections still feels, as far as I know, that Mr. Butters probably cut off his finger intentionally, but Mr. Butters has made a lot of arguments in all of this material, and I hope you have all read it.
I have read it, and it's interesting to me that we now have another evidently a self-appointed attorney for. He's got now advice coming into
Mr. Chair,
of letter.
I noticed that it was from his friend, his lawyer in prison.
Yeah. Well, now it's
not a lawyer. I mean, his whatever in prison. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Linda Key, Mr. Morris is known to be a jailhouse lawyer.
He is, and he likes to be nasty compared to some of the previous communications.
Mr. Morris and I have had go-rounds on other matters.
I have members read this one. Anyone want to make a motion?
Mr. Denied. Mr. Lindeke, as I promised, I was going to explain a situation to you. I have to apologize to the subcommittee. When the meeting was rescheduled, both Ms. Lind and I were in the throes of getting the calendar for the Board of Pardons together, and we both believed that the meeting had been rescheduled to 1 o'clock on Friday. Now, by some fortune or maybe divine intervention, I came up to Mr. Lindeke's office this afternoon to deliver my response to Mr. Butter's claim, and was told that he was at the claims subcommittee meeting. So I apologize. Ms. Lindy is not here. I am familiar, however, with her claims, and I'm prepared to proceed. And if the subcommittee would indulge my giving you this response at this time, I would be happy to go through it.
Okay, this was, we did have kind of a split decision, I think, last time.
Senator Ham and Olsen voted to deny the, did not vote to pay the Butters claim. I believe Senator Lack voted to pay the Butters claim. Representative Onselt was not here, and the two representatives both voted for the claim, I believe. So it was two representatives for, one senator for, and two senators against.
I renew my motion. My motion.
Angelic, Representative Angelic moves to deny the claim. Are there questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Oh, let's see. You got to have two on that side.
Oh,
right,
some people didn't vote. Oh, I see.
There's not two senators voting to deny.
That's right.
And there sounds like there wouldn't be two senators voting to pay it.
But we're stuck.
Unless
Senator Olsen has been persuaded by the information.
So perhaps it must remain open.
Just leave it open for a while? Sorry? All right, we will set the...
We'll try again.
A tie for another tie.
But you'll supply us with your response, right? You can leave those right here.
Bad hearing today.
And we'll all read them later, Mr. Hartman. Thank you.
It's true. I got help, though.
All right. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chair, the remaining claims are all prisoner property claims. And... I'd like to ask that a few of them be taken out so that we can deal with them. And on the rest of them, even though I'm getting softer and softer as the years go by, and I ask more and more questions that I wish could be resolved by the department, on the rest of them, my recommendation would be they be denied because there's no clear evidence that the department did anything wrong. So here's the ones I would recommend that we take out. There's one from a person named Ron Butler Bray. My understanding, is this correct, Mr. Hartnett, is that Bud Cooper has been paid.
Mr. Lindeke, I apologize. I don't have the circumstances of these.
Maybe it was somebody else that got paid. But anyway, let's take out Bud Cooper. Audie Fox, which sounds like a car that I had one. And Nino Giving Sandman Shellershell. Those are the ones. There's Ron Butler Bray. There's Bud Cooper. There is Audie Fox. And Nino Giving Sandman Shellershell. Concerning the medicine bag.
I have a suggestion for dealing with Mr. Chairman. Dealing with the huge amount of files and paperwork that we get, and we get it, it's sometimes one big packet and some extra ones. If we could develop a numbering system so we could refer to the cases 11, 27, 18 on our docket for the day, and we could just, as things come in, put them into that order and have at the top. I tend to, as we're going through them, I tend to put like 3A or 3B on the pieces related to the agenda. I don't know if that's too difficult, but it does feel like it's, I'm challenged by it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker and Kimberly Kershak and I will discuss the proper way to organize these before the next meeting.
Okay, I mean, no offense, I know you get a minute, it's a point in time too, but just to keep us all on the same.
I believe these were in alphabetic order, but I'm not positive. Yeah, the rest of the claims, I would recommend that the committee deny them, other than the ones we just pulled out.
Here we have.
It's possible some of the rest of you have some to pull out and talk about. No?
Mr. Chair, just a question.
Carol Zink.
Like, is David Dawson?
Let's not worry about Mr. Dawson. Okay, Representative
Walton. Hey,
Senator. Unlike Senator Lance, who was a representative, you weren't. That should never have been promoted. Yeah. Sorry, Senator Walton.
Hey, do we have any motion? To carry out Mr. Lindeke's suggestion.
So moved.
Okay, the motion has been made to deny the claims other than those that have been identified by Mr. Lindeke. Any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, the claim of Ron Butler Bray. What concerns me here, among other things, was that this person in this person's claim indicated that there were 18 pages of material. This claim is page 1 of 18 pages of material from the claimant. I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is, where are the other 17 pages? And the response from the department, there is some kind of an inventory that the department is talking about in its letter, indicating that the claimant signed for some property, signed a property inventory. Where is that? And where is the form indicating that this item was sent out? Because the department seems to be indicating the item was sent out. And yet, those forms just aren't in here. So I'm troubled by this because there seems to be a complete lack of proper documentation about this claim.
Would you suggest we just set that aside so you can, or do you have...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, when it's our standard operating procedure to provide the subcommittee with all the documents that we receive, and typically if I know that when I had been reviewing claims, if it appeared that there were more documents that reported by the claimant than were in front of me, I would contact the facility. But
in this particular case, having reviewed Ms. Lynn's responses to these things, I do not recall the situation at all, so I would ask that this be set forward so that we get to the bottom of it.
Okay. All right, the next one,
we'll set that one aside
then, Mr. Chair. The next one is Bud Cooper, and my understanding was Bud Cooper had been paid. I have an email here from Nicole, in which she says, "Hello, can you please have Craig and Michelle, that would be Michelle Timmons, the reviser, review this email if they would like us to pay this claim?" Actually, Kimberly was sending me. She's the one who said hello. Nicole says that if they would like us to pay this claim, we can do that before it goes forward to the subcommittee. My response to Nicole was, yes, please do that. And my understanding was that this one was then paid by Nicole, by the department, and that we need to consider it further. But you don't know anything about that.
I do recall that a claim was paid in response to a recommendation that Mr. Liddicky made. I'm assuming that was the Cooper claim.
So I think we can set the Cooper claim.
The Cooper side.
Audie Fox. We got a letter recently. I was recommending that this claim be... My comment on this one was that these confiscated items apparently still exist. They're being held as contraband. And then we got a letter from Audie Fox, dated the October 30th, saying, "I would like to discuss my property claim that was submitted to your committee for review. If they do have all of this stuff that is allegedly contraband, I would like to have it sent out to whoever it is he wants to send it to. And rather than continuing to hold it, and I don't even know exactly what it is, Mr. Fox wants you to send it out. So hopefully you can look at this one further and figure out how to deal with that."
Mr. Chair, Mr. Liddicky, if subcommittee would allow me to kind of explain, Mr. Fox misstates the policy regarding contraband. The policy says that contraband, which is otherwise allowed and becomes contraband because it is altered, can be sent out either to or destroyed at the request of the owner, once the owner, the offender is. In this particular case, the contraband that we're talking about were drawings, presumably being used to make tattoos, as well as drawings related to security threat groups. The motorcycle club. We view that type of contraband as not being allowed in the first place, for the same reason that the two shanks found in Mr. Fox's room 2 months before this were not returned or sent out to anyone. It would be our position that the contraband, which is related to security threat groups, would simply be destroyed because it's basically pieces of paper with drawings on that are not allowed in the prison.
So the claim, Mr. Chair, is for papers, drawings, greeting cards, and FBI reports. What about the greeting cards and the FBI reports?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Liddicky, the greeting cards also had pictures related to the particular security threat group. I apologize, I don't remember the name of the motorcycle gang. The Warlocks. It's listed as a security threat group in our agency, although Mr. Fox has taken issue with this, so that's because they're on the watch list by the FBI.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I suppose the thing to do might be to deny Mr. Fox's claim.
Move to deny.
Okay, motion is made to deny Fox's claim. Any questions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
And Mr. Chair, then I suppose the department will follow whatever the department's policy is on this contraband material. That's going to be destroying it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Liddicky, our OSI is our Office of Special Investigations. The gentleman that is in charge of dealing with security threat groups currently has this material. I don't know whether he's using it by way of further investigation of this particular security threat group, but once that evidence is no longer needed, it will be destroyed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the last claim is the claim of minnow-beezing. Oh, not good. Is minnow-beezing Sandman Shellyfolk. And this claim has to do with a medicine bank, and an Indian medicine bank. And the department, after my discussions with Nicole, doesn't question the fact that they are responsible for the loss of this medicine bank. As I understand it, they gave it to a person who was a volunteer at the facility, who handled Indian things, who promised to take it to a medicine man to have it sewn up, which was the only way it would be allowed into the prison. They handed it to Mr. Greg Davis. It was never seen again, and then Mr. Davis was prohibited from coming to the prison for some unrelated reason.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, it's my understanding that Mr. Davis was prohibited from coming to the prison because he failed to respond to inquiries about the medicine bag on a number of occasions.
So, Mr. Chair, you asked me this morning to give a call to Mr. Davis and see if we could find out more about the medicine bag, and I did. It was not a difficult thing. Maybe he sees the DOC's phone number on his call. He knows they're calling, but when I called, he just answered the phone on the first ring, and I had a nice chat with Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis tells me that he did bring this and a number of other things. He had apparently other Indian things in his car, and he drives a Saturn, by the way. And he had driven back to the reservation, back to the Millac Ojibwe reservation, and his car was stolen. He only got it back a week or 10 days later, and it was at that point in Hinckley. And they had taken, of course, his entire stereo system out of the car and everything else of any value that was in the car. So he got his car back, but in very bad condition, and these things weren't there. He apparently, he tells me, knew who he suspected who had stolen his car. These were people who had lived with him at some point. And he later talked with them. They said they were drunk at the time they did it. They took all that other stuff and put it out in the woods, and they have no idea where they put it. And so Mr. Davis says that there is virtually no chance that this medicine bag will ever be found again, not and returned to Mr. Sandman Shellyfolk. So that's the story on the medicine bag. And then the only remaining question, since it's clear he won't get it back, and since it's clear that the department was basically negligent in some way in giving it to him without any further controls, and the department seems to admit that, the only question then remains the value of this beaded medicine bag, which his grandmother made, and which he claims is worth $1 million, and which the department claims can be worth no more than $75 because of department policy. And so I asked a person, and we have actually a lawyer in our office who is an Indian, and she checked on the value of beaded pouches, and the closest we could come was the least expensive one she could find on the internet, and she did talk with some other people about how to find out the value of these things, was one that sells here for $469.99. It is a Sioux Indian medicine bag. Here's another one, a beaded pouch. This is the kind of the way they look, and you can see these aren't sewn up. This one was $563. So we know that medicine bags are worth something, and we know they're worth more than $75. That's all I know about this point. You admit responsibility for the medicine bag, I believe, and we need to figure out how much it's worth.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, Mr. Mark Thielen is Associate Warden at Oak Park Heights, and he's here because he has special knowledge about the religious coordinator and that job.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mark Thielen, I'm the Associate Warden at the Maximum Security Prison at Oak Park Heights, and I'm also the DOC Religious Coordinator. I became familiar with this case just a few days ago when I heard that it was coming before this committee, so I did a little checking and pretty much the progression, and Mr. Lindeke explained it very well as to exactly what happened. Mr. Davis is a Native American resource person who had come to the Rush City facility with Mr. Staples, who is a medicine man who comes as a resource person to conduct sweat lodge and some other activities. The reason the bag was given to Mr. Davis was because the religious coordinator at that facility saw that it was open when it came into the facility. And as soon as it comes in and they are open, practice and policy is that they're sewn shut in front of the offender by the religious coordinator, so they cannot be opened again. This was open, and he saw inside some of the traditional pieces in a medicine bag or medicine pouch, which would be a bit of cedar, a bit of sweet grass possibly, some bitterroot, and possibly a bit of tobacco. These are all very personal things. That's why I think the offender, when he said, what is this worth? He said $1 million. You can't put a price on it. This is a very personal belonging for American Indian offenders. They pray with it. It's used for it to help defend them in times of need. And some of the things inside of these bags, which sometimes will include a hair of a relative, possibly a deceased relative. In this case, there was also some of the hair that was on his head when he was born and a piece of his umbilical cord. His grandmother had assembled this for him. It was very important, very special to him. Again, that's the reason he said there is no price. $1 million, whatever, there is no price. You can't look at on the internet and come up with a price for this. It isn't. Ours is $75. That is what it was made out of, and the contents is worth about 75 cents if you want to put a price tag on. In this particular case, I wasn't aware of what happened after Mr. Davis had been successful in contacting. I just knew that he hadn't returned calls or had made promises that he'd return the bag, and no one at the facility was aware that his car was stolen and that what was in it is gone, probably for good. He was banned from the facility for not cooperating, but Mr. Staples was also banned from the facility for possession of tobacco when he came in. This is a tough one. I don't know what to say other than how we decide the dollar amount for something like this is almost impossible to come to an exact figure. Nothing is going to replace this. He can get another medicine bag. These guys can get them from the American Indian Resource volunteers, from some of the elders, from some of the medicine men, and they will bring them into the facility. They will bring them in open. They will show staff what is inside. Staff won't touch it. They will sew it shut in front of the offender and stay that way. Now, they can only keep this medicine bag. They can wear it on a plastic breakaway necklace underneath their clothing. They can wear it outwardly at a service, at a sweat lodge or a pipe and drum ceremony, or in their cell. Otherwise, they can't display it outwardly. Offenders can't display any ornamental jewelry outwardly in the facility. So he can get another one. He can have it filled with things that he wants to have in there. My guess is he will have another one brought in, so he can have it. We just can't replace the one that's lost.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Well, as I read through this, and I read it all the way through, including some of the comments with regards to the that was sent back to this gentleman from the religious coordinator. And have you had an opportunity to read
So the kites and the comments that came back on the kites?
I did see them, Mr. Chair.
And there were comments that, to me, that I'm not even affected by it, but as I read it, was what you could really see is the temper on the with regard to the religious coordinator was getting a little short. He was sending me all these kites, and you know, what's wrong? Don't you trust your own people or something to that effect? I mean, it was really inappropriate, very inappropriate from my perspective, you know, and that's not knowing, you know what else was going on between the individuals, but it was evident that this person was very concerned about that bag and just kept constantly asking about it. That's why I went on the internet about 2:00 this morning, and I came up with Mr. Davis's phone number and where he works, and Mr. Lemke was kind enough to give him a call and find out what was going on. And so, to say the very least, I'm quite upset by the way this whole thing is being handled. The lack of sensitivity, it seems to me, on a religious matter, by individuals that are responsible for this type of activity. And also the, I know that they sent, you know, they got in here a copy of letters they sent by mail, and it didn't come back, the registered mail, and it didn't get a response. I know that frustration, but it seems to me something that was getting to be this kind of seriousness that from an individual standpoint, there were other avenues, other things a person could do. I know my next call is going to be to the chief executive of the Ojibwe band to find out what's going on, because this gentleman worked for the Ojibwe band. And there was no reason why, if he wasn't going to respond, why couldn't somebody else in his organization respond? It's not like they are, nobody knows who they are or where they're at. It's some black band, and they're on the internet. You know, all their phone numbers by individuals. I mean, it's very easy to contact them all. And so I don't know what the value amount should be. I know that my suggestion for discussion is that if it was my decision to make, what I do is talk to the make contact with the Ojibwe band and the leadership of the Ojibwe band and ask them for some assistance in this and see what their opinion is as to how this sort of thing should be taken care of, because obviously one of their people is very involved with this, and I also recommend that the organization, the corrections staff, don't let things out of their control. I let people take it off site. I don't understand why that happened. If all it had to be was thrown up, why wasn't that done right there? Why was it given to somebody that hauled it off and eventually got it stolen out of his car? And now it's irretrievable.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That was a mistake by the religious coordinator at that facility. All he would have had to do was sew it up. He thought he was safe by giving it to a member of the band and not just letting officers or property people or somebody else look at it and decide whether he could keep it or not. He felt safe. Did your people understand the significance of these medicine pouches? It's safe with you. He just wanted to know if he could have the stuff in it. He really didn't understand the significance. I think he saw some of the tobacco and thought, okay, we've got contraband here, which is not the case with the American Indian community, even in the facilities. So he does, he admits that mistake. I did speak with him a couple days ago, and that was my first question. Why did you do that? Why did you let it go like that? And he said he saw the stuff inside and was afraid.
And as the thing went through, just the lack of sensitivity, I'm surprised, you know, that the religious coordinator was getting that upset with.
Mr. Chair, I think part of that was he was telling this guy, look, your people are involved. This is yours to your people. Why are you accusing me of stealing or mishandling or doing something with your property? I got your people involved with this. I wanted it that way. He felt safe giving it to an Indian resource person. It wasn't the right move. But he felt that there was no way anything could happen to it. These people know the significance of medicine bags.
Well, I didn't know that much about it, but I sure found out about it in a hurry.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about the maximum value on religious items. All offenders in our system are permitted to have 5 religious items. Religious, I don't know if Mr. Lindeke recalls the discussion we had many years ago about photographs. The value of photographs for replacement is fairly small. It equals about the cost of getting, now of course that's changed because of digital photography, but at the time it equals the cost of getting a reprint, essentially. We went and had some discussions. Obviously, there are cases in which a photograph will have an emotional value that far, far exceeds what the intrinsic value is, the value of the paper, how much it would cost to get it a reprint made. And sometimes the reprint can't be made because that is the only existing print. But be that as it may, we simply don't have any way of knowing that. All other property that we bring in, we put a limit on it because an offender may decide, well, what I really want to have while I'm in prison is my Rolex watch. He can't bring that into the prison. With religious items, because of the significance of religious items in the First Amendment rights, we allow them to bring them in, but we give them the warning that the maximum value on this item will be $75. Now, it's not just a medicine bag, a Quran that is bound in leather, a rosary that is blessed by the Pope. Any number of religious items could have a replacement value far exceeding that $75. If I had a family Bible that my grandmother had recorded my mother's birth in, well, it would probably sell at a garage sale for $2, would be invaluable to me. And there's no question of the value of this item to the offender. The difficulty it is we have almost 10,000 offenders with the possibility of having 5 religious items. And if each offender were allowed to bring in religious items with a replacement value that was beyond because of the emotion, and I know that that's valid, but if each religious item were paid for on the basis of its emotional value to the offender, we would simply, that would be an untenable situation.
And all those comments are very valid in most situations. In this particular circumstance, though, I think that the negligence with regard to the actions of the people at the institution is very high on the list of reasons why we got a problem. And then the runaround that this person got, literally months and months of trying to find out what happened to his medicine. And I know my own religious background, so that's all I can relate to. But if you have something that is very extremely significant to you from a spiritual standpoint, and you're being denied that, that's got to have a lot of, and you're not in the best situation in your life in the first place, it's got to really add into the anguish. Now, we don't deal with pain and suffering, but if we did, this wouldn't be a case that I would be looking at.
Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses, I share a lot of your frustration. I mean, from the very first communication that we see here, he said, 2 weeks, this is the longest I've ever been without this in my life. And it's not, he continually reinforces that it's not the value of the bag, it's things that are irreplaceable that connect him to important people and times in his life, including the umbilical cord that was part of his mother. And so, you know, it seemed to me that not having a standard policy that those are sewn shut in front of the possessor, which you said was your standard policy, I haven't heard you reconfirm that you have returned to that policy, but it seems to me that that's absolutely critical. Because this is not like a leather-bound Quran that you could just order off the internet that have, or a family Bible even. This is some things that you can't even, that have even more personal kind of connection. And so it feels to me like the value is far more than whatever the value of the bag itself is, or like an antiquity or a collectible is. And that may have been part of why it was attractive to whoever stole this car, or maybe they pondered, thought maybe they could pawn it or something, who knows, or maybe they were just drunk and threw it out, we'll never know. But it does seem to me that it has a value far beyond the value, and the fact that he says it up until this point, it had never left his neck except when he was swimming or bathing, says how closely this was valued by him, and it's just amazing to me that it wasn't, that isn't reflected here in the comments, nor in the valuing of it. And I do think that there needs to be some pondering of that within the system.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, in this particular case, again, we have policy in place that dictates how these medicine pouches are dealt with when they come into the facility. There is policy and it's followed. This time it wasn't followed. This religious coordinator looked inside the medicine bag. It looked like to him there was contraband in that, but wanted it confirmed by a Native American resource person, a medicine man. So he gave it to somebody who could confirm that and make sure that what was in it was okay to be in it, and then he intended to seal it. He thought he was doing the right thing with this. He did not follow policy, however. So I don't want to minimize that at all, the importance. That's why I said immediately when I saw in there where he had said, what was it worth? He said $1 million. I said, well, of course, it's $2 million, $3 million, nothing. There isn't a dollar figure you can put on this with him. They're very important to the American Indian community. The religious resource person knows what policy is in regards to medicine bags. He didn't follow it.
You had discussed in your conversations regarding photos. What was your conclusion at the end of that?
Mr. Chair, photos were, I believe, and it's been a long time since I've dealt with photos, so it may have changed in the intervening years, but they were 50 cents per photo plus $15 for the album.
Chair?
Senator.
On page 2, he talks about the tribe's lawyers are waiting for a decision. Is there some kind of action planned, or do you guys know about that?
Not that I'm aware of, Senator Olson.
What recourse would he possibly have with his lawyers? Anybody?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I suppose it's possible, and this is just conjecture on my part, that they could file a tort claim for conversion. I suppose they could possibly file a 1983 action related to the department interfering with the constitutional rights under the First Amendment. I don't know how successful that would be, but that would be one possibility.
Mr. Chair, well, I know that for injuries, the only remedy that the prisoners have is to come to the subcommittee. But for property, that's not the case. They can attempt to get recovery for property in a lot of different ways. And I recall one that we had just a year or so ago involving the number 88, which it turns out was Dale Jarrett's number and is now going to be Dale Earnhardt's number. And on that one, the person who claimed that his television was improperly confiscated by the department on the basis that they thought he was a Hitler Aryan person using the number 88, which means Heil Hitler, on his television to signify his belief in that. And she said, of course, he is just a Dale Jarrett fan. But walking through the prison at that point, I believe, he found a judge who actually held, I mean, that was we didn't have to pay that claim because the judge ordered you to pay it in a conciliation court proceeding. Pay for this guy's television set. I recall that. So there are judges occasionally, there are conciliation court proceedings. People can sue and get recovery for damaged or lost property in a lot of different ways.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, I have not been personally involved in a conciliation court action. I know that offenders have filed them. Our position has always been that I believe it's the Tort Claims Act that specifically excludes prisoner property claims.
Okay.
which leaves them with the remedy that we have here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm intrigued by your idea of consulting with the tribe to see if there is some wise counsel they might offer, but I also think we might want to also ask if I'm not familiar with this religious tradition, but I know it has special ceremonies and rituals just like most religions, and if there is some ritual that would assist this person in relating to whatever the replacement is to make sure that that's authorized within whatever correctional facility he's in at that time, or he may have been released by now, but just to make to if he's not, or if he reoffends and ends up back in a facility, to make sure that whatever that connection can be reauthorized. Has he been released?
Mr. Chair, Representative, he has been released. There is a several ceremonies that American Indian offenders are involved in at times of grief, at times of very difficult times during their lives. One is a smudging ceremony where they will use the sage and cedar and burn it and waft the smoke around themselves as a cleansing ritual. The other is Inipi, which is a sweat lodge that they can participate in, and that's where they would go in and pray.
I think that if members are and I'm wide open to suggestions, but I'm going to suggest that we set this aside, allow for this gentleman to be contacted and informed at least to the level of information that we have, and that I think you may want to contact, or you may want to make sure you're talking to the Mr. Davis directly, where you have verified information. Not that we don't trust what we're doing here at the committee, but we want to make sure that the department has the information directly, not just hearsay to us. And that, and then see what he wants to pursue. As it's listening to you, it sounds to me like there are some other legal avenues that he could pursue, and he may want to take advantage of that before he comes to here as a last resort.
And Mr. Chair, can I suggest that if he has been released, that the next time we hear this claim, assuming that we do, we invite him to come and testify to us about what was in his medicine bag and the value of it to him?
You know, if he were here, what I would be advising him is that he should contact the Ojibwe tribe leaders and let them know what has happened, and see if there is some type of assistance that they can be in this whole activity, because they played a part, whether even if it was just transporting material and having their car stolen, which we don't have a lot of control over that, but the not answering phone calls and having this thing drag on for a long time makes me, you know, feel like it might be a good idea to get some leadership involved in this whole thing and let them have a talk and discussion. But I don't think the decision, at least from my understanding, is really one that we need to take at this point. That if we can kind of just give some time and get some communication going and have him actually informed, as Mr. Lindeke says, he was told today that there's no chance that he'll get that medicine bag back. That's some real tough delivery of a message, and I have no idea what his reaction would be after that and what he may want to attempt to pursue. Very much.
It being apparent that he has been released, is there, would he informed about the good things that they're doing here today and his opportunity to come here and testify today?
Mr. Chair, I would say that Kimberly Kershak and I were not aware that he had been released, and I doubt that she informed him. But we could certainly, I mean, I'd like to hear more about it, what he'd like to do to him.
Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me that, you know, a basic aspect of due process is the right to be heard. And I can understand if someone's incarcerated that can't come here to testify, but I think it'd be incumbent upon the correctional facility that is subject of the claim to ensure that a person who's claiming scheduled for hearing when they are released they notify this committee that the person has been released, and they make sure that the person being released has the information so that they can attend and testify to what you do. So, if that needs, maybe it needs more spelling out than currently exists, if you need to put it in the rules of the committee or some other directive. But,
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't think it would be necessary to have it in the rules of the committee, but in my experience, Mr. Hartnett has been very good about responding to requests by the subcommittee, and probably if that's what the subcommittee wants, Mr. Hartnett would make sure that that gets done.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, Senator Ladd, when there are claims, obviously the turnaround time on property claims tends to be a lot shorter, this claim notwithstanding. But, for example, on injury claims, we always inform the claimant if they're released from prison to keep us aware of where they are. And in the 13 years I've been working at the department, I've gotten one letter from an offender telling you that they had moved. So, certainly we know when people are being released, and generally where they're being released to, so we can certainly follow through with that.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the notice, we need to ensure the notice is given to them as they're being released. So it doesn't matter if they let you know where they moved to.
Okay, we'll set this aside for now. Any objection to that? Okay. Are there, what else do we have?
Mr. Chair, we don't have anything except I noticed, Senator Lass, that Cheryl did bring all of our books of testimony that we're supposed to read before tomorrow's hearing. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lindeke, the contents of the book are preparation for tomorrow's hearing. Most, if not all, the contents should also have within the last few days been emailed to the members of the committee as they arrive. So hopefully the members will have a chance to take a look at this stuff and to take advantage of the information that is there when formulating questions for our witnesses tomorrow.
I have one question for Mr. Hartnett yet. You know, we had so much discussion about procedures where stuff was lost, remember? And has anything been tightened up on those procedures? Because in the last hearing, you know, we talked about, you know, guys were going to go to court or something, but their clothes were gone, and, you know, it was like, why did this stuff get lost? It seemed like there were some procedure problems in their personal property, you know, I was just wondering if anything has been done to try to tighten these up so that these things weren't happening.
Mr. Chair, do you recall that one, Mr. Hartnett? I do vaguely recall that one. It was a claim by someone who was going to be going to court the next day. His family brought him a suit to wear to court the next day. The check-in people at the prison apparently, and nobody signed for anything, and it was never delivered to him, and so the next day when he went to court, he couldn't wear a suit. And they were going to tighten up the procedures so that every step of the way, when the clothes are given to somebody and then to somebody else to give to the prisoner, that there would be a signature, and we would know that it was proceeding along in some way.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, to tell you the truth, my recollection of that is probably vaguer than Mr. Lindeke's is. I will, however, talk with Ms. Lind and find out what efforts were made, and then if more needs to be done, we will take care of that.
Mr. Chair, I think the case that you're using as an example was actually a Department of Human Services, and I think it was maybe connected with St. Peter, one of their facilities for people with mental health issues.
Exactly right,
Representative Loeffler.
Right, I just, that's my recollection.
Please identify yourself.
I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor, and I have been sitting in so I can fill in as Mr. Lindsay's successor, and I recall it was the Department of Human Services as well.
On the edge of your chair all afternoon.
Yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair, that would probably explain the vagueness of my recollection.
But on that issue, I'm wondering, since you deal with people who are, in essence, oftentimes homeless, they don't have another location or another support system to hang on to their valuables. Is there a way that you make available to them a storage for a small something of value while they're incarcerated, if they had, say, a particularly valuable piece of jewelry or those sorts of things? Maybe you can charge them for rent, but is there any kind of accommodation for that? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, our policy says that if an item comes in that's not allowed, for example, a piece of jewelry, jewelry with stones, for example, is not allowed because the stones have been known to be pried out and used as barter items. Or watches that exceed the value, we do allow for those individuals to send that out. In a case where there's no one out there, I don't know exactly what would happen. Though we do store certain things such as driver's license, identification cards, social security cards, and that sort of thing. But I don't know that our facility, the impracticality of it is if you separate the property from the offender during the course of a 5-year incarceration, that offender may be moved 40 times. Sometimes into different cells, sometimes into different facilities, depending on their security level, their behavior, etc. If there were a storage place at that facility that had valuables in it, my concern would be that somehow that valuable would be separated from that offender and it would be a bigger problem than we currently have.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend that you hold on to the claims that we've set aside and not throw them away.
Oh, sure, and I had mentioned that.
I have
not. It'll have to be hunted out again. We'll have to. All right. And we're ready for the hearing tomorrow. So until then, we are adjourned.